Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Another Sunday, and it's Night Call. Broadcasting from Detroit in the Midwest of the United States. Some of you listening around the country, some of you around the world. Most of you right here in the Detroit area, southern Ontario, southeastern Michigan, northern Ohio. Welcome to the broadcast. I'm doing it all alone. My partner in thought crime, Jalene Jordan, off for the evening. She'll be back next week for sure. In the meantime, you want to call in? Just me and Al Slayer here, manning the phones. Although we're having a little bit, you've heard this one before, a little bit of a technical glitch, but it's no problem on your end. Al will answer the phone, and we'll... although he has no way to tell me who you are or what line you're on, but we'll get through. But it is a talk show, and we have open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF, and Al's been working on that. He may have just stepped out of the room for something, so if you're starting to ring, as I see some of you are, please just keep ringing. 313-298-9743. For those of you who are bashful or when the lines are filled, you can go to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And the MySpace page, myspace.com/nightcalldetroit. Although we found out that there is, in fact, another night call, something in New York. I don't know exactly what it is. And I, dear friends, can you tell this in my voice? I was been to the doctor, and he says, you're beginning to sound like Marlon Brando in The Godfather. He says, you have chronic pharyngitis. You go, whoa, man, what's that? Am I going to live? And he said, yeah, for quite a while, particularly with that, because it's just sort of an irritation of the pharynx created by all this pollen in the air. And I've never had it this bad. I get it from time to time. So help me out here. Get on the air. 313-298-9743 is the numeric number. I don't know why in the hell I start with this loser. Mitt Romney, the flip-flopping once liberal governor, Republican governor of Massachusetts, now far-right-wing conservative freakoid running for the presidency. Actually, he's running to be nominated. So, you know, what the deal is on all of this is that they have to appeal to the base in each party. So the base of the Republican Party are similarly these conservative right-wing freakoid twistoids, right? So he has to just everything he ever said about abortion and gay rights and stem cell research and the rest of it. So he has to sound like the rest of that wacky pack that's running from the right wing. And here from the Associated Press, it says, Romney says he wants big stick. What a headline, right? Okay. Romney says he wants big stick. Well, Mitt, I've got your big stick. Republican President hopeful Mitt Romney said Saturday that if he's elected, he wants to, quote, carry the big stick by increasing the size of the nation's military. We already have this enormous debt, right, this national debt that it has the potential of just sinking the whole boatload, right? I was going to say something else, but so that might sound like an odd phrase there. The former Massachusetts governor said his plans include boosting the size of the military by at least 100,000 troops and increasing the military budget. The United States has the largest military budget in the world. In fact, it has, I believe, the largest military budget larger than all the rest of the countries combined. If not, it for sure has a military budget. Some of you folks, you can look this up. Tell me whether I'm right or wrong. It for sure has a bigger budget than all of our allies and potential enemies, whoever the hell they could be, right? You know, we're using making enemies faster than we can kill them, thanks to, you know, the current policies. Romney recalled the words of President Theodore Roosevelt, pardon me, who said the United States should speak softly and carry a big stick in foreign relations. And he also complained, Roosevelt did, the first Roosevelt, that the United States had no stomach for empire. That's when they talked truthfully out. I mean, one time, I'm forgetting all this stuff, but I think it was Senator Beveridge. I love that name, too. Senator Beveridge, I think from Massachusetts, someone, you know, who's got a history book, look it up. He said, the markets of the world must and shall be ours. Either we have to have empire abroad or revolution at home. This is back in the 1890s. So they talked about empire. They didn't talk about all this crap about spreading democracy. None of these guys believe that. Yeah, and that's stuff for the rubes. Don't be a rube. Don't believe rich, powerful politicians. Yeah? I mean, remember I've been saying this over and over again. Best way to think, they're on television, they're wearing a suit or a uniform, they're lying. All right? I'm not saying they all are, but I'm saying that's a better assumption than to, oh yeah, well they said we're in the Middle East to promote democracy, as opposed to oil and empire and military and intelligence reasons, right? So most start that way. All right. Why did I think I would get right into this? So here, Romney, I thought none of those guys were cozying up to George Bush. Some, I can't remember who it was. Some comedian just the other day said that Bush's approval ratings are lower than the guy with TB. You know, the guy going around the world with that that virulent strain of TB, that guy's approval rating is higher than Bush's, dropped down into like 26%. I mean, who the hell still is defending him? Well, Mitt Romney defended Bush's performance, noting his policies extend beyond Iraq. Yeah, they do. He called Bush a statesman who has shored up the nation's economy. We'll talk about that later. Well, if you're ultra wealthy, if you're a major stockholder or something like that, you're doing well. The rest of us are either worried. I mean, is there anybody that's not worried? Anybody that said, I'm absolutely certain that my job is secure. I've been at WRIF a long time, and I'm not absolutely sure. I mean, every industry in Michigan is suffering. Absolutely every single one. And cutbacks are the name of the game, right? So, I mean, to say that he's expanded the economy, he's expanded the economy for his rich buddies and left us paying the bill. I mean, if you think about what the war in Iraq has cost us, the taxpayer, and also what it's going to cost, over $2 trillion eventually when you factor in every aspect of it, including lifetime medical care for the now 1 million vets of that war, it comes out to that figure. And that means instead of paying the bills here in Michigan, we're in a deficit situation as well. We have to start cutting services and first responders and what have you. So, let's see. He called Bush a statesman who has shored up the nation's economy, expanded renewable energy capabilities. When did he do that? And chosen appropriate U.S. Supreme Court justices. Whew. So this is raw meat for the right-wing base of the Republicans. And it's there. I mean, that's the twistoids that represent the 26% of the American people who still give Bush high approval ratings. So here's where I wanted to go with this. Mitt Romney, running for president, says everything he did. Well, let me back up 1 minute. Romney is the son of a Michigan governor, George Romney. And Romney was running for president in 1968. He was in the Republican primary. Same deal. And he had supported the war in Vietnam. That, you know, another one of those wars, based on lies, frittered away our fortune as taxpayers and richly rewarded the war contractors and the wealthy who made a fortune off the war. War's good. That was one of the calls at the time. War's good business. Invest your son. Right? Except the rich never did. The middle class never did. It was up to the white working class and minorities to make all the real sacrifices. Yeah, you know, people like Bush and Cheney, they just scammed out. You know, never did a bit of service. Chicken hawks is the word for those folks. Where was I with that? Romney, yeah. So Romney famously said, I was brainwashed. I don't understand why this sank him. But he said he had changed his mind on Vietnam in 1968. And they said, why? Because he said, because I had been brainwashed about Vietnam. So here was this guy actually speaking some truth. Because just like the war in Iraq, it was based on a pack of lies. There was no need to go, in that case, 10,000 miles from our home. No reason to spend billions and billions of dollars. No reason for the U.S. forces to kill 3 million, you read it right, 3 million civilians in Vietnam. And no reason for us to lose 60,000 of our men. And still paying the costs in Agent Orange for both for our veterans and also for the Vietnamese who suffered it even worse. So was he brainwashed? Yeah, well, so were the majority of American people this time around. If you thought there were weapons of mass destruction, you were brainwashed. If you really were paying attention, you knew there wasn't. I mean, I knew there wasn't, and I'm just reading news accounts just like you. But a lot of people, what does Noam Chomsky call it? Willful ignorance. Willful ignorance. And let me say, by the way, another salute to Al Slayer, who's answering the calls and figured out what was wrong with our computer, so now I can see who's who. So let me get to the end of this Mitt Romney thing. So he's talking about how wonderful Bush is, and at the end he says everything he does from the standpoint of what is best for the American people. I mean, I can't even believe he would utter that, let alone could he conceivably believe that? Everybody I know puts such an emphasis on honesty in their personal relationships and their political dealings and their desire for peace and social justice. Do these liars really lie to themselves to the extent they believe it, or do they know it's a lie? I don't understand this. All right, so let's. I even jotted down a couple of things. I can't keep track of all this stuff. I mean, it is crime du jour, you know. De jour means per day or something like that. But, like the soup du jour means the soup of the day. So it's the crime du jour, the scandal du jour, the corruption du jour, the scandal of the day, the corruption of the day, the lie of the day. It goes on and on and on. I can't keep up with it. Now, Jalene Jordan, who's not here tonight, my producer, she's as ADD as I am. You really, I love Jalene, you know that, and she and I have been partners for a long time. And if someone said you could have any partner in the world on the air, I would say her. But, you really need a producer that is not ADD, but you need a producer that's obsessive compulsive. And she and neither of us are like that. Because we need a third person, an obsessive compulsive person that would do nothing except scan the news and say, every week I want a list of all the scandals and corruptions and lies being told by the Bushoids, by Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, the racket posing as a government, right? And then we'd have a list. So I just started jotting down a couple. Let's see. Oh, yeah. This whole thing now that Cheney and Condoleezza Rice are arguing about Iran. And Condi doesn't think we should bomb them. And Cheney thinks we should because he's completely crazy, right? We have a madman in as the vice president. Mean and dumb. Everything he's proposed has just taken us to hell, right? So they have that confidence. They have that self-confidence when they speak. Because they're used to lying in public, and they have also this self-confidence born of power and privilege and never having to accept the consequences of the last pack of mistakes that they made and the last pack of lies, even when they get caught. If you lie in your personal life, if you lie in your professional life, you catch hell. Or if you're going to speak, you probably don't speak very frequently in public, so you might speak a little haltingly. But these men, and, some liars like women liars like Condoleezza Rice and Harriet Myers and people like that, they speak pretty well as well. But it's because no consequences for getting caught for mistakes or lying or what have you. And also the confidence of wealth and power. So I was listening, and what they're talking about is, and you hear this on the news, Iran is meddling in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I heard a newscaster talking about that Iran is stirring the pot in Iraq. What's the country that's like doing that the most? Is it Iran, who has a common border and a common religious culture with Iraq? Or is it a bunch of gringos who have come 6,000 miles away? And you know, I'm not disparaging the troops. I'm telling the guys that sent them there. Nobody in Iraq, except for the mercenaries there, the so-called military contractors, the mercenaries, a better name for them, is over there because they say, I want to go there. I mean, the mercenaries want to go there because they're making a fortune, right? And they're fighting more and more. They're killing Iraqis left and right. So who's really meddling in Iraq? Who's really stirring the pot in the Middle East? Of course, it's George W. Bush and the United States. Bush has, and it's not like he's thinking, oh man, I gotta move a little to the center. I can't be this far right wing freakoid all the time because it doesn't work. I've got 26% approval rating. 74% of the people think I'm a stinko. I got to do something. You know how they do that? They start moving to the center. They're a little, you know, left, and they got the left, and they move. But he's just appointed or nominated a judge who, in one of his opinions, says it's okay for an N-word to be used in a workplace, and that it wasn't racist. That the Supreme Court, here's Romney complimenting him on these far right-wing Catholics that he's appointed to go along with his other pals on there, that they've made two decisions lately that on technicalities a worker would be denied her rights, and this affects lots of other workers, and someone who was tardy in appealing a murder conviction, even though he got incorrect information from the judge, they said, no, sorry, too bad, just stay in there for the rest of your life. Iraq, of course, is a continuing nightmare. But having absolutely no shame, and it must be what I said really, it must be that they realize no matter what they do, they figure it ain't going to come home to bite him in the butt. You say, well, what do you mean, bite him in the butt? 74% of the people think he's stinko, think he's a liar, think he's an incompetent, think he's a fool. Think that, Snarly, the vice president, they think Snarly is even worse. But so why don't they just like alter stuff a little? Well, any number of guys have bailed out, including the counselor, you know, the consigliere, Dan Bartlett, who, one of that. They're starting to desert, the sinking ship, the rats. For sure. Dan Bartlett quit, so Bush had any number of people that he could have appointed. So who does he appoint? The high-ranking advisor to Bush is going to enter the White House with lobbying ties to dozens of companies seeking the federal government's help on everything from proposed acquisitions to patent disputes. It's Ed Gillespie. That's right. He used to be head of the Republican Party. And he was named the next White House counselor. He's a partner in a firm called Gwynn Gillespie & Associates, a lobbying firm whose clients include Sirius Satellite Radio, which needs antitrust approval to acquire XM, Qualcomm, which wants Bush to veto a federal agency's ban on imported cell phones made with its chips, and the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, a trade group trying to limit drug industry regulation. Essentially what they're saying here is anybody that they want Bush to veto any legislation that would allow us to get cheaper generic drugs, of course. Now, I love this sort of understatement. Consumer advocates lamented Bush's decision to put Gillespie in his inner circle, fearing that the interests of an average citizen would be trumped by those of corporate America. Well, gee, do you think? According to Joan Claybrook, president of Public Citizen, the group started by Ralph Nader, someone I've interviewed a couple of times, it's very disappointing that the president, given his lack of public support these days, has not reached out for someone more independent who has a better understanding of the needs of the people. Now, remember, Mitt Romney said that that everything he does doesn't have a capital H. He's talking about Bush. He does from the standpoint what is best for the American people. Now, is there even one of you craven Republicans out there that would call me up at 313-298-WRIF and say that the appointment of a White House counselor who has ties with a lobbying firm that has business before the government and the president will be an honest broker? An honest broker. Let's see. Is that all there is in that? Oh, yeah. So they've got all of these different groups that they're talking about here. The firm earned $17 million lobbying. Where was this? Other Quinn Gillespie clients, Amgen Incorporated and Genentech, biotechnological drug makers, trying to put the brakes on legislation that would allow generic drug companies to sell cheaper versions of their medicine. Right! Just keep looting us! We're sick! We're sick! Our parents are sick. Our grandparents are sick. We're sick. I'm not saying we all are, but those are. And let's squeeze as much money as possible out of these sick people. God. One of my colleagues, Mike Malloy, says, have I told you yet tonight how much I hate these people? And I know hate's not good and what have you, but these people are so evil. They're so vile. Isn't that an anagram even? There's no brakes on them. There's just no brakes on them. They're just looting. All right. 313-298-WRIF. And that's just that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the tip of the iceberg. And you may know more things about this kind of stuff than I do. Call us up if you do. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. And what's the defense here? Is everything I said a lie? I mean, you know, I'm sure that, you know, the 26% of you that's still out there say, well, I think that Bush is a good guy. I mean, is everything I just said okay? Now, is it all right for your grandparents to be charged lots of money for their meds because these greedheads in the pharmaceutical companies want to gouge as much money out of them as possible? Do these people have a bit of compassion? Remember, that's what healers are supposed to be all about. This compassionate sense of going to people and healing them, not robbing them. Hey, he's sick. Let's rob him. That's the Republican credo. He's disadvantaged. Let's rip him off. Right? He's hurt. Let's mug him. That's what a racket does. This is the mafia. 313-298-9743. All right, I'm just going to, I don't know what order these came in, so I'm just going to blast down here from the top. Let's start with Mark in Redford. Mark, hi, it's Peter Werby without Jalene Jordan. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Pete, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Hey, I've been listening to you for the last 15, 20 minutes, and you make total sense. It's amazing. I want to admit right now that I'm a proud American, but it's getting tougher and tougher to live in this country. They're giving all our money away. We take care of all the people in the other worlds, and we're not helping ourselves.
Now, the only thing I would disagree with you, Mark, is we're really not helping anyone. We're not none.
Well, no, I'll reframe that. We're giving our money away to helping a lost cause.
That's right.
We're killing our guys left and right. We should have got rid of Saddam and left.
Yeah.
Yeah, the war, Bush, he's screwing the country up. But we should be giving the money back to our people and take care of the homeless and the ones that are starving here.
Well, you know what? Mark, can you turn your radio completely off, please?
Oh, can you hear it? It's off in the distance. Here, turn it down.
Okay. All right, go ahead. Yeah. What has to happen in this country to make it economically viable? I mean, it's so much that has to be done. But the first thing that ought to be is a $50,000 tax exemption. So right off the top, that if you make $53,000, you pay taxes on $3,000. Because and you say, wait a minute, man, we already have a deficit. Well, make it up off these people that are spending like $2 million on their their daughter's confirmation and hiring Rod Stewart as the entertainment and
writing it off as a tax deduction, definitely.
Yeah. So
but our unemployment rate, they're saying, is a certain percentage, but that doesn't include the people that have exhausted their unemployment.
That's right.
So those aren't in the statistics. The poor people that are living in poverty, living on the streets, and they're saying, oh, yeah, well, we're doing good. The economy, the stock market's booming. Yeah, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. It's the same old story all our life.
Well, you know, it actually has turned around. I mean, for a while, if you go back to our grandparents' generation,
they used to stuff their money in their mattress. They didn't trust the bank. Yeah, no. Well, we got to go back to that now because what do they give you? 0.72% interest on your money?
No. That's what I meant. That's not what I meant. I meant, like, when the Depression was over and, you know, the World War II took us out of the Depression in the 40s and the 50s and into the 60s, our parents and our grandparents saw entree, even of of, you know, if you were working class, if you're working at Ford or Chrysler or something like that, that you could provide your family with a middle-class income and that the benefits that you had for medical and for retirement and all that were there. Well, now it looks like we're going in the other direction. So who needs tax relief is certainly not the rich, but the middle class and the working class and the working poor. Well, the working poor really don't pay any taxes. But you shouldn't even pay any tax at all for the first $50,000. And you say, well, just start putting a heavier and heavier and heavier tax on the wealthy. And, I mean, these people that are making like $125 million a year, I mean, that's insane when we have people that are having trouble making ends meet, that foreclosures are increasing, that one bad turn in one's health and it can send us into ruin and make us lose our house and what have you. And so you take a guy that's making $125 million and you leave him with $5 million a year. Oh, man, what a commie I am. All right. Thank you, Mark. Let me get some other calls. Appreciate you calling 313-298-WRIF. Here's Tim in Detroit. Tim, it's Peter, and you're on the air.
Hey, Pete. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the caging issue. I'm trying to get my brain wrapped around this. I heard about it from Greg Palast.
Caging.
Yeah, and as I understand it, it comes out of the advertising industry. You know what they do is they send out mail, you know, advertising companies do, and the addresses that aren't valid, they discount them. Well, Tim Griffin, who was Karl Rove, head of opposition research in 2004, had this caging program going on in all the 50 states and also over in Iraq. So what they would do is they would send, for example, ballots.
Wait. Let's set this into a context so everybody can get this. What we're talking about is a Republican strategy emanating from Karl Rove, who's still up there in the White House after committing all these indictable crimes, and what their schemes are for defeating the Democrats is any number of ways to stop potential Democratic voters from casting their ballot. One technique is called caging. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, anyway, according to the Palast, and I think his data is pretty accurate, yeah, because he even got a lot of the emails from Rove himself. In 2004, they had sent a lot of these ballots, you know, to various voters they thought were Democratic. And what would happen is they would get back, you know, the addresses, but then would claim, you know, they weren't there anymore.
Right.
And this also occurred to, you know, voters in Iraq, you know, who are U.S. troops. So they had figured out somehow that these voters were likely to vote for Democrats. I mean, they, for example, they would target a lot of African-American troops.
Soldiers, yeah, right.
In Iraq. Right. And, you know, statistically, African-Americans are more likely to vote for Democrats than Republicans.
These guys are such racists, you know, to boot.
Now, Palast, he estimated that 1 million voters by this caging method in 2004 were completely excluded from voting for the he wanted.
Yeah, well, let me again interrupt you to say that had everyone eligible to vote would have been able to vote in 2000, there wouldn't have been any question about the election that Gore would have won hands down. And not even if every vote would have been counted, but if everybody, even the scams they did there, but if everyone who was eligible to vote would have been able to vote, same thing in 2004, that the election again was stolen through any number of methods of discouraging or through a number of other tricks. Tim also is talking about Greg Palast. Many of you have heard him on this show before. It's Greg, PALAST.com. You can go to palast.com. So what happened, though, Tim, in 2006 was, as Palast said, he was saying that they're going to do the same scams, and they did, but the vote was so overwhelming for the Democrats that they were able to take, what, 45 seats or something?
Well,
he
estimated that because I think they won 29 or something, but he estimated that actually 50 seats could have been taken.
Sure. Sure.
So that's still quite a scam, you know.
Yeah, but, and the Democrats are such wimps, you would have thought they would have gone at this with, who doesn't defend themselves? They can't even get them to muster the kind of defense that they should. All right, Tim, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Here's Joe. Joe's in Dearborn. Joe, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, what's going on?
Just doing this show and you. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say you're blaming Michigan's economy on Bush. I just want to know how you can do that when Jennifer Granholm is the one who lost the high-tech Toyota factory to Indiana.
Well, how did she lose it?
She didn't put a bid in until the last 3 months of it, and then Indiana gave them a bigger tax break, and it went to Indiana.
Well,
you can go both ways on this.
Well, I don't know the details of that one particular situation, but the economy of Michigan has, and its poor performance has, deep roots. Part of it has to do just in general with deindustrialization that began 50 years ago when small union shops figured, what the hell, we'll go to the American South and pay crappy non-union wages. And then more and more to overseas. Also, for the second time in about 25 years or so, the big three became uncompetitive in their designs and their cars. And I don't have anything for Jennifer Granholm in the slightest. What's his name? Roly-Poly before, the governor before Granholm. He repealed these taxes, which eliminated a lot of the, a lot of the tax revenue. And could she do more? Maybe. I don't know. I mean, let's call up. Did she screw up on that? I don't know. Maybe she did. And if so, she deserves a lot of criticism. Got to take a break. I'll be right back. Thank you for your call. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan's off this week. We'll be right back.
WRIF.com.
What did you expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said, jump away, leave me to myself, jump away.
WRIF.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Without Jalene Jordan, all right. That tells you a couple things. First off, turn your headphones down. I don't know why I like them so loud. In any event, Jalene's off for tonight. Steve writes in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com. Where are the podcasts? There hasn't been a new one since May 20th. So that's like three missing. Now, Al Slayer has been putting them together. I don't know what the hell is happening, so I'm going to check. But stay with that. All right, two huge issues that hit screens in Washington the same night coming up Wednesday, June 20th. D.C. premieres of Sicko, of course, the film about health care by Michael Moore, and also War Made Easy by Norman Solomon. And Norman Solomon is... an interesting guy. He's been on this show any number of times. You can go to normansolomon.com, S-O-L-O-M-O-N.com. Now, Sicko has been bootlegged. It's on the Internet already, even before its official premiere, which I think is the 28th. Is it here somewhere? But I heard an interview with Michael Moore, and he said, hey, you know, if it's being bootlegged, good. The more people that see it, the better. He's already shown it to California nurses, and there is some preview up north, isn't there? Anybody know about that? 313-298-WRIF. Norman Solomon's movie is called War Made Easy, and it's about how 50 years of lies have got the United States into war after war after war. Let me see. Through painstaking research and fast-paced editing of archival footage, the movie exposes a 50-year pattern of deception that has dragged the United States into one war after another, from Vietnam to Iraq. So you think, man, why? I mean, it is terrible. Why would these corrupt politicians, and that's all of them. I mean, it was Democrats, too. You know, who got us into Vietnam? What's his name? It was Eisenhower. Kennedy and then Johnson. Johnson really made the big push. And, of course, old Tricky Dick, Nixon. But trillions have been made by the war industry. So it's about a military-industrial complex. Great documentary about all of this is called Why We Fight. Check that one. This just in, too. Benedict writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'm one of the ones who have bootlegged Sicko, and I've written a rather personal review of the film. My review is the small attached text file, and if you feel appropriate for your show, feel free to read it on the air. Well, it's pretty long. Can't do that. But people are already checking it out. Well, I mean, doing kind of these notes here, there is an event called the Allied Media Conference. It's going to happen in Detroit. Is it next weekend? I guess I can't do the... It is the 22nd, so why can't I figure this out? Yeah, that's next week, next weekend, right. It's going to be at Wayne State University, and it says the Allied Media Conference is an annual weekend-long gathering of alternative media makers and social justice activists. The AMC brings together a cross-section of media workers, community organizers, filmmakers, radio producers, publishers, web designers, and artists whose work makes... a lot of sense. Breaking silence, building movements is, I'm laughing at my own little internal jokes. Don't worry about that. But in any event, I'll be down there at least for part of it. You can go to alliedmediaconference.org, alliedmediaconference.org. It's open to the public. And if you'd like to be part of it, if you, you know, have something you'd like to contribute or learn, it's the place to go. You can also go to my website. Go to my website, and you can find, anytime you go on, like you're driving your car, and you say, wait a minute, what did he say? Conference, when? You know, what's his book? What's his DVD? All of that is on my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. And there's a calendar there, too. If you go over on the left side and go down a little bit, you'll see the calendar. Historian Howard Zinn. You know, he has a People's History of the United States. Well, he has a sort of a condensed version of it called A Young People's History of the United States. You know, most history books sell 30, 40,000 if they're being required for classes. People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, Z-I-N-N, has sold 1.5 million copies. And if you think either history is boring or you don't know it, Howard Zinn is the place to begin. A People's History of the United States is really the place to go to start getting a, just as it says, not all the rich politicians and military men, but the people that have made history, the common people throughout our history. Number one book on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's not the liberal New York Times, but rather they're compiling what books are number one. The Assault on Reason by Al Gore, which is this frontal attack on the Bush administration. The Assault on Reason. Number three bestseller still is God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Christopher Hitchens. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Let's go back to our phones. Here's William in Dearborn. William, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I just have one comment to make. I know I kind of heard you talk about Mitt Romney a little bit and just dissecting a little bit about how he really isn't a stand-up guy or this or that. I actually just moved from Massachusetts not more than 2 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And in Massachusetts, and I don't know, and I can't give you the exact facts, but Massachusetts' economic situation is just outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually, I'm not married, but I do have a baby mama, forgive me for saying, but she had to go on the state health insurance there, and they really have almost better insurance than where I work for the state. And, you know, I'm not really so much Republican or Democrat, but just looking at his track record in Massachusetts at the economic status and then the health care programs for the statewide, for just the people who can't afford it or don't have it, and then coming back to Michigan, it was just so disappointing, not only to see just the economic status out here, but also just to look at, from my girlfriend's standpoint, that she really can't get good health care out here. Some people won't even see her with the health insurance they offer through the state here. And
isn't that terrible?
Well, man, not to mention the fact that is there a road that isn't being worked on right now? I mean, with the gas prices so high, I just don't know where to drive anymore. I think that I have to go 20, 30 minutes out of my way to get anywhere.
Well, here's one of my points, William, that he has moved very, very far to the right. And if you said, would you advocate the same programs and the same policies of tolerance, like for sexual preference and other liberal issues like health care for everyone, you would say, hey, this guy's a breath of fresh air.
Right.
But he's moving away, way, way, way far to the right, away from all that. That was my point.
Well, and I know, and it's just disappointing because I'm a Michigander all my life. I did move to Massachusetts for 2 years, and out of circumstance, you know, I had to use the public health care system out there. And to my surprise, it was just wonderful. And I come out here, and I kind of see that, you know, unfortunately, like I said, I have to put her on it, but it's just not the same. It's just not the same level of service for the public.
Now, I've read some, without seeing it, although I've seen little pieces of it, of Michael Moore's documentary, Sicko. And it really brings into stark human relief, just from even the trailer that I've seen, the damage that that not having a universal single-payer healthcare system has for our country. It's just terrible. But we can't afford to fight wars all around the world. We can't have a Mitt Romney who wants to increase the military budget if he was ever elected president. So we have to really take, take a choice. Are we going to send all of our money to these military contractors and war industries and have this empire and go all over the world with armed forces, or are we going to take care of ourselves? I think that's quite simple. William, welcome back to Michigan.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Oh, glad to do it. Thank you. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Brian in Clarkston. Brian, thanks for being so patient. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing good.
I wanted to get to the point where the medication is so expensive for the elderly.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it is. My grandpa he actually lived to about 99, almost 100, but he had a bunch of heart problems and everything.
Yeah.
And his medication was so expensive, they could only get about half of it, and that's why he died.
Well, I mean, he lived a pretty long time, but I've told this story before, and for those of my apologies, I've heard this before, listener, and don't want to hear it again, but I was covered and am by Union Health Insurance, and I went to get a copay. This was several years ago, actually, because of the cost and a lot of other things. Copays have gone up. But so I got this medicine for my wife, and I paid like $15 as a copay. So I was kind of off to the side, and there was an elderly couple, both of them very small and very thin, and I remember that they said to him, or the clerk said, that'll be $347. And they pulled out this wad of cash, and it wasn't filled with hundreds, and it wasn't filled with 50s. It had a couple 20s in it, but they were down to the end counting out ones. I shrank away from there, like somehow that I had done something wrong. It gave me such a terrible feeling. I mean, if anybody should have been pulling out the $347, it should have been me, and they should have been walking away with $15 copay. But here you have Bush's buddies and Bush's new lawyer who works for a firm as a lobbyist that wants to make sure that the little old couple keeps paying that money. Because as I was saying earlier, this system is about looting, and it is exacerbated. It is increased under Bush code. It doesn't even make a slightest a pretense that it is anything but a racket for the rich. But you're right, it is a sad situation. And I mean, we always think of it sadder when it's for our elderly, but there's people at every level, infants, children, teenagers, adults. I mean, so frequently, because I'm the public affairs director for WRIF, I get requests for people that are holding benefits for ill members of their family or their community. And I think it's good that a family and a community is coming together to help their own. But I'm thinking, man, if these people, if their bowling event doesn't come across well, what's going to happen? They're not going to get the care? I think not. This is really criminal. Really criminal. All right. Thank you so much, Brian. Appreciate it. Here is Michael. Michael's in Shelby Township. Michael, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Doing good.
Good. You were talking about Iran earlier,
mm-hmm.
And I know, I think it was last week you mentioned you had a bet with a friend of yours on whether the United States was going to invade Iran or not.
Or attack. It's not going to invade. Attack.
But I actually still believe they are planning on doing an airstrike in Iran, and the reason why is, and I actually do hope you win the bet, though. But
you hope I win.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because
you
are betting that they will not invade.
They will not. Yeah.
But you're starting to see more and more rhetoric in the news media about linking death in Iraq with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found really interesting is about a month and a half ago, I read an article that was from an ex-intelligence officer that was stationed in Iraq that was actually saying that less than 8% of the deaths that are linked to explosive devices, it's less than 8% that is actually directly linked with Iran, and over 60% that is linked with explosive devices that are from Sunni insurgents coming out of Saudi Arabia.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, that's who's funding them. I mean, who the hell is the United States fighting? There's this right-wing religious Shiite government that is friends with Iran and has got all these religious connections, and we're funding them to fight these other Shiites, like the Sadr Army. And then we're also fighting the Sunnis, but sometimes we're arming the Sunnis who are being financed by Saudi Arabia, who are our allies, because we're hoping that one section of the Sunnis is going to attack Al-Qaeda.
Yes, and these are Sunni insurgents that were actually fighting us prior to us arming them, and we're hoping that by arming them, they'll stop attacking us, which just doesn't have any logic to it at all.
If it wasn't so catastrophically deadly to our troops and the people of Iraq, it would be just a magnificent joke, because, again, it is the absolute incompetence of these conservatives that they've shown all over the world whenever their policies are brought into into reality. I mean, they just ought to have their little journals where they can put across all their stupid, mean-spirited stuff and not bother the rest of us. But somehow, through this real hard work over the last 25 years, they virtually have become the government, even though all of their policies represent such an infinitesimal minority. All right, thank you, Michael. Here's Bob in Shelby Township. You guys in the same room or same house?
Oh, no, not the same house.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, Peter, I just want to mention that, I used to listen to your show all the time. I used to, back about 15, 20 years ago.
Really?
Always listened to Night Talk. It was great.
Yeah.
But thing that's different is now that, I've gotten older, been through a lot of career changes, opened a couple companies, did a lot of business moves. What I'm seeing now in this country is a shame that we all see the problems, the catastrophes, everything that's happening around us, but we all still pick sides between Republicans and Democrats. We're not deciding that what the real problem is we need a viable third party.
There you go.
We really need to get together and collect our energies and say, look, we're not going to stand up for this anymore.
But
we're not going to put up with it.
Here's the problem. Both parties are bought and paid for by the big corporations. I mean, it's more direct, and the Republicans act more directly in the interests of the big corporations. But what does Hillary have? $25 million or something like that in her war chest? So it ain't coming from little donations like from you or me, right?
Right, and I agree. But the thing is what I want to do is try to channel everybody's energy that we agree that things are messed up, and we need to change it. But you know what? Put both of the parties down.
Well, I agree. I don't spend enough time. Get the Democrats in. I spent the 90s, if you remember, lambasting them. All right, listen, I'm sorry to cut you short, but I have to do these commercials before midnight. So thank you. And hopefully other people will bring up this theme. I agree with you. All right, we'll be right back. Actually, just me. Jalene is out for tonight. Peter Werby, 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
Give me a word, give me a Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our second hour. Remember, at 1 a.m., I'll have a couple of pre-recorded interviews. One with my old pal Danny Schechter. He's director and producer of the DVD In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst. Scared the hell out of me, the DVD did, and also talking to Danny. But it's given us information that we need. In fact, it fits in with this email I received from Robert from Port Huron. He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, talking about these abusive practices of a particular bank used against me. When I stopped using my credit card, the balance was $375. All of a sudden, they claim I owe them over $2,000. Now, my wife is going through the same problems with the credit card company she's dealing with. And they're threatening to sue her, and they know full well she doesn't have the money to fight back. Can you address this problem that has grown out of control since Bushko took hijacked the White House? Well, listen up to this, Robert, and check this DVD as well. You can go to, what is it, indebtwetrust.com, indebtwetrust.com to get a heads up on it. Also, oh yeah, I was mentioning earlier the Allied Media Conference at Allied Media Conference, what is it, .org or something like that. But it's on my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. I spoke with Joel Breitbart and also Mike Meadow, organizers for the Allied Media Conference. It's going to be in Detroit June 22nd to the 24th at Wayne State University. Right. All right. You're talking about the hypocrisy of Mitt Romney. I mean, talk about what do they call beating a dead horse. Walt wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, I listed the top three current Republican candidates from least likely to most likely to force you to vote for Hillary. Now, did you get that feeling? Why is everything in this society blackmail, right? You know, you're going to say, vote for Hillary? And they say, well, you don't want John McCain to get in. He says, he's the third least likely, right? He wants to double the military force in Iraq, but he's also the only viable candidate to condemn the torture of detainees. And more stuff is coming out about what happened at Abu Ghraib, by the way. Two, second, Mitt Romney. To answer your question, no, he does not believe his own BS. I don't think he actually has any real views. He only wants to say what he thinks will go over well with his audience. And number one, nose-holding time, Rudy Giuliani. He's the same kind of chest-beating chicken hawk as Bush. Also, he's completely inexperienced in foreign policy. We just saw what incompetence in attempting to maintain a tough guy image leads to. Let's not have that happen again. Uh-huh. All right. I agree with that, to be sure. All right. Our final caller, not for the night, but the final one in a row, just coincidentally, is David from Shelby Township. And Delby, hello. David in Shelby Township. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's not Delby, it's David.
Right. yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. I agree with most of everything that you're saying. It's I'm a first-time caller.
Welcome.
But thank you. I'd like to get more down on a personal level, and I think that people in general should get up on a personal level and get involved in their government, in their city or township, and vote for the people that they think will do them the best good. You were saying earlier that you didn't know who the governor was before Granholm.
You know what? Before you take me to task, let me just say that I've always blocked on the man's name. I have forgotten his name publicly. I can't begin to tell you how much. I can see him. I can see his wife. I can see his twin daughters. But I cannot remember his name. What is it?
Well, now you stumped me. But, you know,
I thought you were going to take
me. I had the same problem.
Yeah.
It's hard to think of him because he stole from the city and the whole state of Michigan. But Engler.
Engler, John Engler. Governor John Engler, right.
Yes.
Right.
He did pretty well for this state for, two terms, if not a full three. Granholm is just not getting it done. She's taken away from the school children, and, she's hyped up the lottery, There's just a lot of things going on the local level.
Wait a minute. Here's her problem, though. She is required by the Michigan Constitution to have a balanced budget. You cannot run a deficit budget the way Bush is running the United States. So she has to do something. I mean, they're talking about, they have to do cutbacks. Something has to be cut. I mean, it seems insane, of course, that you want to cut school aid. But
well,
where? What are you going to cut?
I think health care. For the unwed mother that are just collecting benefits and not working and when they could be working.
We got a bad unemployment problem. You're talking about unwed mothers, by the way, which the percentage has really gone down. Where in the world are they going to get jobs where when you have like a job at the casinos open, 2,000 people show up for 100 jobs?
No, well, of course they do, but...
I got an idea. If you get rid of these pesky child labor laws, maybe you could have them and their kids kind of force them into cleaning up the trash or something like that. I don't know. All right, well, we'll keep thinking. Thank you. Appreciate it. Here, this ties into what David was saying. Most in Michigan want to drop the flat rate for graduated tax. I can't remember that either, but there's a Michigan tax. I pay it. Was it like 3% or something like that? But anyway, how many states are there? It says it in here somewhere. But there's only a few states that have the flat tax. The rest of them have a graduated tax. In other words, the more that you make, the more that you pay. So people in this state can't particularly, lower middle class, working class, we can't afford to pay any more money. Think about this. Billions and billions and billions and billions and billions that add up to like a trillion are going out of our coffers, out of our pockets, really, not even out of our out of our pockets, going to the national government, who turns it over to Boeing and Blackwater mercenaries and Halliburton and all of that. So they're getting rich off of all this, stockholders of those companies, whereas... we have to think, well, let me see, do we want to cut back on the fire department or do we want to cut back on our kids' schooling? That's the blackmail again that I'm always talking about. But let's see if there's anything in here. It says strong support is stunning. A majority of Michiganians, it says here, favor ditching the flat tax state income tax and imposing a graduated levy that would take a larger chunk, that's my word, from the rich than the poor. According to Detroit News WXYZ-TV poll. Well, I think that ought to start at the top and get like the ultra wealthy and tax them enough so that we don't have a budget deficit. And, and not spread it to people that can't afford it, like the majority of people in this state. U.S. home foreclosures in May jumped 90% from a year earlier, reflecting a poor spring housing market. That's what they're concerned about. Oh, I guess this is like a real estate thing. I mean, what human misery this cold statistic announces. I don't know if any of you have ever had your house foreclosed. I haven't. But can you imagine what that must do to somebody, to their to their lives, to their sense of themselves, to their sense of security, to how they appear to their friends and their community and their family. So it's up 90%. So you get all this stuff. Oh, the economy. Where was, I don't know, that's too far gone about how Mitt Romney was saying that that Bush has done so well for the economy. I can't find that one thing. Well, that's what he's done it for the stock market, the people that got the big investments there. But for the rest of the folks, 90% increase in foreclosures. And Michigan leads the nation in foreclosures, as you'll hear in my interview with Danny Schechter at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. And Wayne County leads the state. And there's thousands of them. In the meantime, and this is more economic blackmail, of course, contract talks between the U.S.-based automakers and the United Auto Workers begin next month, but the key issue is already clear, eliminating the roughly $25 an hour labor cost gap between Detroit and its Japanese rivals. Officials at General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler said Wednesday that reducing labor costs to the level paid by Toyota Motor Corporation and Honda Motor Company will be top priority. So they want to know, continue the race to the bottom. All these hard-earned benefits and decent pay scales. And I mean, if you don't work in a factory, I've never worked in a factory, but I've known enough people that have, and I'm sort of aware of what, you know, I mean, you got to, I'm sure friends of mine have said, you got to work in one 8 hours a day for a number of years. I mean, I have friends of mine, auto workers, spent 30 years in there. And the noise, the I mean, everything that's conducted or connected with industrial production, including ill health, by the way, that there's no limit to the amount of money that people should be paid for this kind of activity. So you have, again, well, here, let me see. And nowhere is it more critical than Ford Motor Company, which lost $12.7 billion, and mortgaged its assets to fund a turnaround plan that includes thousands of job cuts to shrink itself to match lower demands for its products. Well, it's also partly a speed-up, so people are working harder and faster and what have you. There was some real key point in here, though, that I thought I had marked. The three automakers generally pay about 30% more per hour in wage, pension, and health care costs than Japanese automakers. Well, too bad. That's because they don't have a union. That's what unions do. They don't depend on the market. Because if it's up to the market, and this is what's happening, they want market forces to control our wages. Now, I know you can't say, well, I want $200 an hour. The companies wouldn't be able to pay it. Well, for one thing, the products aren't up to you know, I have two Fords. I mean, I have a wife. She has one. I have one. I'm not real happy with them. I'll tell you. I was working for the UAW as a broadcaster, and that's why I got them. So one is a 01 and one is an 04. And I'm not going to buy another one. I mean, I'll buy like a made-in U.S. Honda or Toyota. I know, they're non-union and all that. Okay, I won't. I'll buy another Ford and complain about, you know, how much they've cost me in breakdowns. I've had to buy an extended warranty because I didn't trust them, that they get the terrible mileage. Does that occur to anybody that maybe that's why the U.S. auto companies aren't doing very well, as opposed to how much wages the workers are being paid? They're being paid a decent wage for doing terrible work. In the meantime, besides that, where is this? Where did I see this? There's one more. When to cut the auto costs, foreclosures are up. Oh, yeah. So this is an attack on union wages, and the Republicans are right there piling on. The U.S. Senate Republicans are vowing to kill an organized labor top priority, legislative priority this year, which means that it would make it easier for workers to form unions. So they want to make it harder. They want to make it harder for workers to form unions. The vast majority of non-unionized workers say they would like to be in unions. But they're terrified. Again, it's this blackmail. You try to start a union, buddy, we're firing your ass. Because everyone knows, every single person, and if you don't, you're really missing the bet, that unionized workers routinely and on average get much better compensation and benefits and what have you than non-union workers. Makes sense. Because you've got a bunch of people that's saying, here's what we want. You go there and you say, oh, sir, could you please give me a raise? No, get out of here. Get back to the shop or get back to your desk. Like that. So what can you do? You got to go back. Because if you give them a hard time, you're fired. Blackmail. Right? That's the nature of it all. Are we going to get to this point? Our Democratic allies, small d, in Iraq, on the third day of an oil strike in southern Iraq, the Iraqi military has surrounded oil workers, and the prime minister issued arrest warrants for the union leaders, sparking an outcry from supporters and international unions. So, I mean, we haven't come to that point yet. They did in the 30s, right? We might return to that. The arrest warrant accuses the union leaders of, quote, sabotaging the economy, according to a statement from the British-based organization Naftana. And said Prime Minister Maliki warned his iron fist would be used against those who stopped the flow of oil. Blackmail. Except this is with, you know, we'll cut your, person we've got who cut his finger off or his ear off. So this is what we're paying money for. This is where our tax dollars are going to this guy that's going to, you know, arrest strikers. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Chris in Imlay City. Chris, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you tonight?
Doing good.
You know, every time I call and I got a subject in my head, you switch subjects on me and it gives me a whole different train of thought.
Well, either one.
Yeah, a couple things here real quick to touch on. One of your callers must have been reading my mind. We need a workers' party here in the country, a blue-collar workers' party. Somebody who's not groomed from birth, that comes from money or whatever, and just is groomed all the way up to that political status. And I think the general perception is of the American public is that these people believe they're royalty and they're acting in all are good. We need someone who's broken more than a fingernail in their line of work to actually address the needs of the common people here.
How about the Greens?
I'm sorry?
How about the Green Party?
Well,
I mean, they're mostly middle class, but they have a number of working class people in it, a lot of people in the trade unions, and they have a pretty good platform. The problem is, like I was saying earlier, two things. One, it's the blackmail deal, which I'll get back to in a second. So say it's Hillary versus Giuliani. I mean, it makes me shudder, right? So,
absolutely.
So if I'm going to say, well, I'm going to vote for the Green, and they'll say, well, you're going to elect Giuliani. And they'll probably be right. Look at how much Ralph Nader, and I don't think this is accurate, but how much Ralph Nader is reviled because people say that he threw the election to Bush in 2000. So you've got that blackmail factor and also the finance factor.
But again, you have an established figure that's heading that. You need someone to come up through the blue-collar ranks that struggled, you know, week to week, and paying his own insurance, et cetera, who really knows what it means to hold on to that dollar in your pocket and make that dollar worth a dollar again.
Yeah.
You can't have somebody who's in bed with somebody else, and you have to get rid of these dynastic kind of people like Ted Kennedy and these people that have been around forever that are so enmeshed and tied up with people they've been doing business with forever. It's never going to change. And the last, I'm going to skip here because I know you're trying to get to other callers, but you were just talking about the unions and the amount of money that's paid for work that's subpar according to what we as Americans expect. I was the president of a local, and it was coming contract time, renegotiation for contract, and I was on the negotiating board, obviously, being the president of the local, and everyone's concerned with more money, and I said, look, you're getting paid a fair wage above board for the local economy for what you do. Why not try to get those health benefits? Why not try to get the money on the back end? Why price ourselves out of work when somebody else can come in here and underbid it?
Well, they see that all as a package. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they're spending it on health care or giving it to you directly as a wage.
It's true. But there is power in numbers when it comes to unions, because if they offer you a package deal, why not lobby for something different that's more cost effective for your employer and your union employees? I mean, there's give and take there. There has to be some sort of mediation there.
Well, one of the things that, these car companies, through their own mismanagement, I mean, if they're paying people too much, then that's just more mismanagement on their part. Because obviously you have to have labor costs geared to your overall profitability. But that ought to be looked at really critically. Like, how much are all these people making? The stockholders, well, obviously, operating at a deficit. There's a real problem there. But they expect a certain high return on investment that is beyond what, for instance, Japanese companies make or companies in Europe. On the other hand, they'll say, well, if you don't get this return on investment, you're not going to get the investment. So, as I said, it all just turns out to be this capitalist blackmail, and we've got to move way, way beyond that. All right, Chris, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. And here's Fred. Fred's in Detroit. Fred, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. It's Peter Werby with you.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, Fred.
I'm calling about the resurgence of fear-mongering concerning national health care.
Okay.
An article in the Detroit News, and I forget the author, he wrote glowingly of our talented doctors and all the amazing equipment that we have in this country, and then proceeded to tear down other countries that are making this effort on behalf of their citizens. And in reading it...
Wait, stop. I missed the last part of they were talking about all the equipment, and then they did what? I didn't hear that.
Oh, I'm just saying that he was talking about how great our doctors were.
Right. right.
all of the great equipment that we have in our hospitals.
Okay.
And then he proceeded to talk about the shortages and all of these things in these other countries, as if suddenly, if we went to national health care, all of our, you know, half of our doctors, half the medicine, and half the equipment would just disappear.
Uh-huh.
I mean, but, you know, when you add tens of millions of people onto the rolls who didn't have all of this great coverage, well, you got to expect some delays.
Sure.
But in the richest country in the world, and maybe the smartest, maybe, shouldn't we expect some delays and to be able to work out the bugs in the system fast?
Absolutely, Fred. But and some of the time, I just saw something about it, the average wait for non-elective surgery in Canada. And one of the things I always say to Canadians, I mean, the reason that there's a wait is because it's underfunded. So where are they spending their money in Canada? One of the places they're spending their money is on the military. You know, Canada does not need an army. I'm saying, they, you know, they've got troops in Afghanistan, and this Prime Minister Harper wants to spend more money on the military. So they can kind of take their choices. They can either have much, much less weight and use the taxpayer money for their health care, or they can spend it on defense or war, essentially. Let's not call it defense. Call it what it is. Could spend it on war and the way Harper wants to be this junior partner of Bush. He's sort of a little Bush. And that's the kind of choices we're going to have to make, because whenever I talk to anybody on this program, whenever I interview somebody and they say healthcare system, I say, yeah, I agree. We should have one. But you know what? We can't afford it. We're already in debt. This guy in the White House has already driven the country into debt. And we've got to make some big changes besides just the healthcare system and the taxation system before we can afford all that. Thank you, Fred. Thanks for calling in. Let's see if we can get this call real quickly. It's John calling in Windsor. Go ahead. You're just about to hit the border?
Yeah, Peter. I'm on I-75 north heading towards the border back into Canada.
North? John, you're going the wrong way. You want to go south?
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to get home, too, at the same time. So.
Whatever. Go ahead.
I just wanted to let you know that, I don't know if you know anything about the ACE program at the border and stuff like that.
Remind us.
Okay, any loads that go into the U.S. out of Canada now has to be what they call electronic manifest.
Okay.
All the paper has to be sent in prior to crossing and whatnot. But it's costing the companies, I went into my boss last month, and the company I've been with for over a year now. I went in and asked for a raise. I don't work for a union company. And the boss more or less just put it on the line and said, look, with all this new ACE, extra money and photocopy paper and printer, because every driver has to have all the paperwork with them, copies of everything.
Yeah.
The computers, they had to hire a new person on staff just to be able to, monitor that computer and set the paperwork up and everything else. I mean, they're in a financial pinch, plus the fuel costs and everything else. You know, I mean, we're just as bad over there. You know, a lot of companies are starting to hurt everywhere around, too.
Well, here's the problem. There's something going on. I mean, I don't know the economic situation in Canada very well, but here in the States, one of the things that these Republicans are correct about, the economy is expanding in terms of wealth increase. And so the stock market's higher than it's ever been in history. There's more and more people are becoming millionaires, people are becoming billionaires. But it's like the pinnacle of a pyramid, and as you go down the pyramid to the middle class and the working class and the poor, things get more and more dicey as you go along. And everything they say makes some sense, because if Ford is trying to restructure and what have you, you think, well, okay, if you're in a bad situation, maybe you would have to cut wages. But the only thing that's never there is that when you say this is the case, that everybody's got to chip in. First off, I'd like to see the stockholders and the executives take a big hit as well, or a hit that's commensurate with what the workers on the line are going to take. And then when the company turns around, that the benefits and the rewards are similar. So if at a point where Ford becomes profitable again, the wages of Ford workers go up correspondingly. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's stay in Windsor and actually go to Windsor. And John, thanks for making our show international. Hi, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Actually, it's funny you were talking about the economic condition in Canada. It's pretty much the same as the U.S., at least where I'm sitting. The only place booming here is out in Alberta, which is all oil money. So it just seems that it's the same everywhere. But all these people are getting rich from oil. And basically the Canadian government, we're trying to go green. So yeah. Ontario government's trying to push away from like coal generation plants and all the oil energy. And we're trying to go toward wind turbines.
What's the last thing? They're trying to go towards what?
Wind turbines to generate energy.
Maybe my hearing's going. Tell me.
Wind turbines?
Well, wind turbines.
Yes.
Okay.
Wind.
I got it.
Sorry about that.
I got it. Well, that's good.
No, it's definitely good, but there's been a lot of projects go up and fail already because they're trying to get private investors to do it because the government can't actually do it because it's sort of a monopoly, but all these projects are failing. And I actually had a new one just kind of fall into my lap, and again, because it's so new, we're having a hard time doing it, but I think more people need to get on board and get behind projects like this.
Well, sure. In fact, where did I just hear something about home generators, like $1,500 or something? I know a lot of people don't have that to just put out, but it certainly pays itself back over not so long a period. And one of the things is that you don't disconnect from the hydro or the electric company here in the States. But rather, you use that as much as you can, the kind of electricity that's stored, and then when you're not producing enough, then you go onto the system.
It's almost like a hybrid car. You can just switch back and forth.
You got it. All right, John, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. Hey, by the way, we've been full. The lines have been full all night, so now there's some lines opening up if you want to grab them. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Are we streaming? We haven't gotten a call nor an email from anyone out of our immediate listening district. So if you're somewhere else in the world, give us a shout or send us an email. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Here's Steve in Westland. Steve, hi, it's Peter. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing tonight?
Doing good.
Lots of interesting stuff tonight, Peter. I was actually, the first thing was with the Japanese, they have a guaranteed employment for life by the government. They also have a government pension and a national health care system. So I'm wondering if that could make up for 30%.
Well, that's interesting. They have a system they call the Iron Rice Bowl, which means, you're right, lifetime employment. But did they still have it? I heard they were moving away from, a lot of these, there's this enormous transfer of wealth that's going on around the world, and including in Japan and including in Europe. So, for instance, auto workers in Sweden and Germany, people where they've just got extraordinary wages and very long vacations and all of that, they're starting to say the same thing. Oh, man, we can't keep paying this. So I don't know if they still have the Iron Rice Bowl.
I called to talk about how corporate interests, multinational conglomerates, are taxed not the same as individual people. In fact, they have to be treated the same as individual people so far as when we pay subsidies to, say, family farms, which only make up a small percentage anymore, for, say, corn, that these multinational companies that own so much land are cleaning up in the name of billions. I think they used to call this corporate welfare.
Sure. Yeah. You had that fellow a little earlier, David, I think from Sterling Heights, was saying that we ought to cut off these welfare mothers. I haven't heard that in years. But I think I figured out at some time, or someone gave me the figures, if half the people on welfare were, quote, cheating, it wouldn't even approach the amount of money that corporations have routinely over the last 150 years taken from the individual taxpayer. I mean, what do you think this war in Iraq is all about? It's about oil. So the whole Iraq war is a subsidy for the oil industry.
Well, I won't argue with you. I spent time there while I was in the service, and I've known this is a sham from the start.
Wow.
So, yeah, keep right on, brother.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let me see. Got to get... If you only knew what I had to do here. Anyway, how about this one? Oil industry scales back refinery plans. Hey, it's down to 317. What a bargain, huh? And no one's even complaining anymore. Anybody complaining about high gas prices? Oh, what the hell? You know, can't do anything about it. A push from Congress and the White House for huge increases in biofuels, such as ethanol, is prompting the oil industry to scale back its plans for refinery expansions that could keep gasoline prices high, possibly for years to come, according to the Associated Press. More blackmail, all right? So you want to get off of oil, even Bush, even his dimness, realizes that we're addicted to oil. He said that a couple of State of the Union addresses ago, right? So we're going to do more ethanol. Of course, it's based on corn, which has to do with subsidies and destroys agriculture, or called, you know, the soil and all that, but whatever. So Bush is calling for a 20% drop in gasoline use, and the Senate now debating legislation for huge increases in ethanol production. Oil companies see growing uncertainty about future gasoline demands and little need to expand refineries or build new ones. That's not why they're doing it. It's because they're making a fortune off us. They're gouging us. They're looting us. They're blackmailing us. That's what it's all about. It's about looting and blackmail. I mean, is that a? I don't think that's a hard concept to you know, wrap one's mind around. And think about this next time, rather than just thinking, you know, this you don't like this or this is hurting you to the benefit of the biggies. Think about it in those terms, and then the pattern begins to develop. Either they blackmail you, see, you have to do this, or, and then there's a threat, you lose your job, you, you know, something like that. Or it is looting. So you work, and rather than being able to fully take advantage of the wealth that you've produced through your labor, this means if you're pushing a pencil or working on the line, rather than it going to you, it is expropriated, it's taken away, it is looted from you and gone through the government, which then goes to its recipients, which turn out to be these big corporations, right? Oh, man. 313-298-WRIF. I'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call.
Hey, wait. I screwed up a little here. Al, stop this. All right. Okay, thank you. I want to do this. Jillian Jordan not with us tonight. She'll be back next weekend. A number of you wrote in, wanted to know where she was, but here she is. Jillian Jordan on Night Call, usually sitting right across from me. She's off tonight, and I asked were we streaming? And any number of people wrote in from Rochester, New York, and Lansing, and from far, far away, Jacob in Oulu, Finland. Shouting out to you as usual. Great show. Thank you, Jacob. One of these days, I'm going to come over there and visit you. It's quite a ways away. Here's Dave and Troy. Dave, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Oh, wow. Okay. I totally agree with what you're saying. Take care of our country. The Bushites, everybody. We need to take care of our country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get all those people home. All the people for the oil. That's what's everybody over there for. It's all oil.
Well, I wonder. It sure is. And they want the
it's
military.
It's money. Corporate
money.
Power.
Right. In fact, I was going to say some other things. But you know what? If you just had to boil it down to three little letters, it's O-I-L. That's it. Yeah?
What's that? O-I-L.
O-I-L. Oil.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
It's
the whole world's built around it.
Well, you know what? It is just at the top. I mean, all of us, of course, want an income that we can have security, and then once we get that security, sometimes we want little goodies and all of that. But most of us, the average person, the common person, your neighbors, your family, we're interested in cooperation. We're interested in helping one another. We're interested in having a nice setting for us to spend our lives in. We don't have any grand plans. We don't want to conquer the world or conquer other countries. We don't want to smash other economies or what have you. That's the kind of activities, pardon me, that ultimately gets us into problems, I'd say. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And let's see, here's Evan. Evan's in Warren. Evan, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
I'm in the labor industry. I was quoting the
Wait, Evan. Hold on. Wait a minute. Are you on a cell phone?
Yes.
Right, he's kind of breaking up a bit. So
okay.
Started again.
Okay, well, I'm in the labor industry.
You're in the labor industry, okay.
Yeah, general labor. I do carpenters, carpet installation.
Uh-huh.
And I went to a job the other day that was flooded with Mexicans. That we walked in, we had the job, and the Mexicans were already there doing the work.
Yeah.
And these are jobs that Bush says that we don't want them. These are jobs Americans don't want to do. But us as Americans walked into this job, and then they were there. We planned on this little 2-week job. And so now I'm out of work for 2 weeks.
Wow. Well, that is exactly the kind of work frequently that that job competition comes into to play. And one of the reasons, I mean, it's a very complicated situation. And one of the reasons that Bush wants, you know, this immigration bill and wants there to be, you know, allow Mexican labor in is because they want cheap labor. And they don't really, you know, he obviously doesn't give a good goddamn about you, to put it very, very bluntly. And there is a necessity for more labor than actually is available, because you know, the unemployment in many ways is fairly low, and there's a lot of jobs that that Americans won't take. On the other hand, there are a lot where you start getting into, like you're talking, carpet installation and what have you, that there is direct competition. And so I don't know what the hell they're going to do. I mean, you know, I'll tell you, the worst thing about it, Evan, is that there is no... There virtually is no solution at this point. I mean, no matter what you would say to do, I mean, say, round them all up and ship them back to Mexico. That would never work. Let them all in. That ain't going to work. So what the hell do we do? I mean, I got a radio show. I'm supposed to be the smart guy, right? Knows all the answers to everything. I'm clueless. I'm absolutely clueless.
You can't fault the work that they do. You know what I mean? They do good work.
Yeah.
You know? They do a good job. They come in there, they do it right, you know, but they don't have insurances, you know, they don't have the right paperwork to be here. You know what I'm saying? If someone gets hurt on the job, then what do they do?
Well, ultimately, you know, and Evan, let me just, the call is not coming across very well, so I'm going to have to not do any more with you on the air. But, yeah, I mean, ultimately, the reason that employers are going to employ them instead of you is they're either paying them less or no benefits or what have you. And there's hundreds and hundreds of cases where Mexican workers were promised like $9 an hour, and then they wound up getting $4 an hour. And what are they going to do? They're going to go to the wage and hour board? I don't think so. You know, they say that they're going to, you know, they get hurt. Right. There's no, you know, there's nothing they can take advantage of. I mean, they can get admitted to emergency, that's for sure. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call and the concern. I mean, one of the things, too, that it's mostly, and because that makes up the majority of people in this country illegally as undocumented workers, are Hispanic workers, primarily from Mexico. But there's a couple million Europeans and Canadians in this country as well. And no one is saying, round up all those Canadians that are here illegally and ship them back to Canada. I mean, some people may say, you know, ship them absolutely all back. But I'm telling you, that because of the structure of the hemispheric and essentially the world economy, so you have these third world economies directly adjacent to first world economies, that it provides the context for all of this. Wasn't I saying this last week? And one of the things that's happened is NAFTA, again, the North American so-called free trade agreement, has knocked down these borders so that it is wound up with something like a million Mexican farms being destroyed. So besides this, these generations-old cultures, it also has thrown all these people off their land because they can't compete with the genetically modified corn that's being imported into Mexico to make tortillas and what have you. So they're ruined. They're financially ruined, even forgetting about what it's done to their cultures. And so they have two options. And the vast majority of them that are, and their families that are ruined, go into Mexico City or some other big city in Mexico and live there in the most terrible, impoverished communities and situation. The most ambitious say, I'm coming where the jobs are, where they're paying the most. That's up here. So what we really need is a hemispheric minimum wage, living wage. Forget minimum wage. Living wage, because they'll say, oh, the market dictates. So you got Ford workers in Milicadores. Am I saying that word right? Milicadores? It sounds wrong. But these Ford plants in Sonora State and Mexico across the border, and they're paying 10% of what's being paid to American Ford workers. And so as long as that's going on, I mean, no one's leaving these Ford plants because with Mexican wages, pretty decent. The plants are decent. They actually have some benefits, sometimes Ford company housing and what have you. But that's not the problem. As long as you have this, and why does that happen? I mean, again, it's looting. It's blackmail, right? All right, let's go onward. Hi, this is Ron in Livonia. Ron, it's Peter. Yeah. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Peter.
Hi.
I want to, this isn't the main point, so please don't hang up on me, but I do want to point out for people that I have read that Eisenhower rounded up 5 million illegals during his administration and shipped them back. So this idea that they can't ship people back, I think is really a false one, but I don't really want to go there.
There was a whole case during the 1930s where hundreds of thousands of Mexicans, many of who were even here legally, and many from the Detroit area were shipped back.
I certainly don't advocate shipping back people who are here legally. Let's make that clear, okay?
Yeah.
It is not a matter of where you come from, it's how you got here. But that's not the issue. I want to go back to the auto companies because when you responded to that guy who was talking about Granholm and she wasn't aggressive enough and she's responsible for this mess, I think you should have been a little rougher with that guy. He deserves wireless treatment, and I'd like to give him one.
Go ahead.
And here's the main thing. The things that are affecting Michigan are mainly national issues which have been caused by that filthy, corrupt Congress, Dems and Republicans alike, and our stinking administration and previous administrations. You know that. Now, here's the thing. With regard to the sales problem with our own auto companies, how come nobody points out that the main problem why things they aren't selling, despite the low quality and all the other issues you may want to raise, is the gasoline prices? And the question is this. Why aren't the auto companies, who surely have the inside resources to know that this is a totally phony energy crisis, just like the one we had in 73. You remember back there that they were saying we were running out of oil and we had to have all these alternatives. And regardless of what you feel about the alternatives, the point is there was no shortage. It disappeared. In fact, Henry Kissinger actually told the oil producers, we want a fourfold increase in oil prices, and here's the deal. All the money gets recycled back to us. That's the main thing we want. Now, the same thing is happening today. This is why we have this oil crisis, because we've got a dollar crisis. And as long as people won't pay attention to monetary issues, they're always going to be scratching their heads, and they won't know what's going on. I explained to you with the work of economist Michael Hudson and his book, Super Imperialism, how the system works. Kissinger and Nixon set it up, and it's been going on since then. Until that stopped, this rape and pillage will continue. But I want to point out, the auto companies aren't interested in challenging the oil prices, because even though they're taking a beating on sales, which is completely unnecessary, if gasoline prices were down where they belong, let's face it, they'd still be selling lots of cars. That is a fact.
Sure.
I challenge anybody to say otherwise. But here's what's happened. They're going to beat the unions with this, just as they did in the 70s. And the unions, just as stupid as they were in the 70s, are doing nothing but pushing up the, you know, serving up the concessions.
They're going to roll over, and they're going to say, well, can we protect the pension, you know, the pensions?
This is the whole game. The auto companies realize we're going to take it what seems to be like a total lose situation, and it's going to become a long-term win because we're going to beat the hell out of these unions. We're going to drive prices down until they're right down there in China, which is where they are going. So
I was talking about the equalization of wages, but they're going at it from the other direction. I'm talking about raising wages hemispherically. They're talking about driving them down.
Of course. Now, Peter, the point is this. There's an iron law in the world that people should simply face. They have to be adults and face it. You get what you tolerate. If you look at history and you look at how people respond to history, you understand clearly. One of the examples you can take away, one of the lessons is you get what you put up with. You get what you tolerate.
I agree.
Now, the people in this country, from the young people to the older people, have failed to exercise the three nonviolent methods that they have to change the system in major ways. And as long as they fail to exercise those things, as long as they think they're going to go to the ballot box.
Tell me quick, because we're running out of time.
I've called you and told you before. We've got three. As far as influencing this government, you have to set forth your demands, and you use an income tax. payment strike. You use a consumer strike where you forego buying big ticket items in order to literally scare the hell out of Wall Street and the government. And finally, the big enchilada, the general strike. If that isn't done, if one or a combination of these aren't done in the near future, get ready for a life of serfdom.
Because I've said that before, that we ought to get ready to thatch our roofs, because they have peasantry. They want to resurrect the social category of the peasantry, and they wouldn't put a lot of us in there. Certainly general strikes throughout history, including in this country, have played amazing roles to get to move forward the living standards of people. And I would challenge people on your behalf and mine, if they don't think that, they think that's too radical, or they think they got something else, let's hear it. Thank you, Ron. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling. And let's get to, we just got a minute or two left. Let's go real quickly. Here's Steve in Rogers City. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. Tell me quick, please.
Hey, I just got one statement. I said the worst thing that ever happened to this country was Clinton letting all them oil companies merge together. You got three people that pretty much dictate this world now, the president of ExxonMobil, BP Amoco, and Chevron Texaco. Them three guys right there, they dictate this world now. And then the government needs to step in and break them up like they did with Ma Bell in the early 80s.
All right. Thank you very much. They have the power, and they are looting us. I agree. Thank you, Steve. And here is Marion in Dearborn. Marion, just can you give me a statement that short?
Well, for people who don't have medical insurance, I have a number here, a 1-800 number. The University of Michigan provides free medical care for people without health insurance. My daughter lost her insurance, and she had to go to an endocrinology clinic, and they took excellent care of her.
Oh, that's good. Well, do you use the Internet as well?
I don't have a computer at the time, but I have a 1-800 number.
Okay, what is it?
1-800-914-8561, and it's called M-Support.
M-Support. Okay. I'm going to take a look. I'll see if I can get it on my website. Thank you, Mary. Now, you're always a great source of information. Here's John in Roseville. Go ahead, John.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Quick comment. If the oil companies are scared to start investing in more refineries, what's going to happen if we reduce the consumption of oil? They're going to raise their prices to compensate because they want their income.
There you go. It's always a racket, and we're the sheep to be fleeced. Thank you, John. I'm just going through these real quickly. John in Sterling Heights, can you do it that short?
Hello, yes. Yeah, shrink it. Those light wreckies.
Shrink what?
You know, we need to get out of the country.
All right. That is simply said. Thank you. And our final caller, Jack, you got to be that quick. Give me your final statement, please.
How you doing there, Peter?
Doing great.
Here's the quickest thing you could tell the American people. 300 million Americans right now demand from Congress the oil companies be nationalized or broken up like they broke up Rockefeller in the early 1900s.
Thank you, John. Or Jack, rather. Sorry, because I'm all out of time. There's a lot more behind all of these, but we can think about it all. Thanks for joining me. Jalene Jordan will be back next week. Stay tuned for a couple of real interesting interviews, including this first one about debt. It is going to scare you.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. This is WRIF.com. with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. You know, documentary films have had an incredible impact on us over the last few years. I think about just how outraged I was when I saw Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 or the documentary Why We Fight. And generally, you get this sense of outrage. You didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. I saw one the other night that scared the hell out of me. And that's a much different emotion. There was outrage in it as well. Joining me is an old friend of mine who has just had an incredible career in bringing truth to power and in that manner, bringing truth to all of us. His name is Danny Schechter. He calls himself, and rightly so, the News Dissector. He's had an incredible career in making documentaries, producing them, at least 20 films to his credit, 8 or 9 books. Oh, boy. Help me out, Danny Schechter. Welcome back to the show.
I mean, either it's a sign of total insecurity because I can't keep a job, or it's because I've managed to do a lot of challenging and interesting things, including working as an assistant to the mayor of Detroit back in 1966 with the late Jerome P. Cavanaugh, then the mayor of Detroit. I was an intern, not in the Monica sense, but as part of a Ford Foundation program that placed various people in local and state government. And I was the intern in Detroit with Jerome Cavanaugh, Jerry Cavanaugh, and another one of the interns, believe it or not, was Richard B. Cheney, now known as Dick Cheney, the Vice President of the United
States. Is that right?
So I actually met the great man at a orientation weekend for this internship, and guess what? I found out we didn't agree on much of anything, and we still don't. So there you go. I lived in Detroit, and I've been back many times, most recently just a few weeks back, and I've made a film called In Debt We Trust, which is about the whole debt crunch that we're all in, really, with credit card debt, mortgage problems, just managing, fighting to pay the bills, you know. And this is particularly timely and relevant in Detroit, which is now has the distinction, unfortunately, of being the foreclosure capital of America, because so many people are losing their homes because of these subprime loans and other deals that they got into, and now they can't afford to make the payments, and they're losing their homes, and in some cases, homes they've lived in for 40 years.
Well, Danny Schechter, let's start right at the beginning. By the way, I should also say Danny Schechter is a co-founder and executive producer of Global Vision. It's a New York-based television and film production company. It's in its 18th year. We're reaching Danny Schechter in his office there. The documentary is called In Debt We Trust, and the subtitle, America Before the Bubble Burst. And, one of the many appealing features of the documentary is suddenly you're in it, and you're talking about, instead of just making a documentary about other people, you're seeing a bit of yourself in it, right?
Well, I think all of us have coped with these problems. It's hard not to get behind on credit card payments and other bills. It's so easy to get them. It's so easy to rack up charges, but then the bills have to be paid, and sometimes we don't have the money to pay them, and so we get late fees and other costs. Interest rates go up, and we find ourselves, deeper and deeper in debt. You know, credit cards started out as a luxury. Only a few could get them, then a necessity. And now they're a noose around the neck of a lot of people in this country because the interest rates have gone way up, the late fee costs have gone way up, and people are struggling to pay bills. If you worked in a factory that no longer exists in Detroit, if you've seen jobs outsourced, if you've seen your economic standard of living go down rather than up, you'll know what I'm talking about, and a lot of people do know what I'm talking about. That's why this problem is so urgent. And I'm really eager to try to get this film, In Debt We Trust, shown in Detroit. It hasn't been seen there. It's been in New York and L.A. and many other cities. But I'd like to get it shown in Detroit because I think people in Detroit will relate to it, particularly because they're living it. They're living through, this experience. And our whole country is at risk now because of all the debt we've accumulated. We have $10 trillion in the national debt almost, and, you know, $3 trillion in consumer debt. You know, our country has moved from production when we made things, you know, the way the factories used to hum in Detroit, to consumption where we buy things at the mall. And every time we do, we tend to, you know, get deeper and deeper into debt. And, you know, if everything is going well, that's fine. But let's say there's a death in the family. Let's say that there's a an accident on the job. Let's say, you know, there's some other unforeseen problem, a divorce or whatever, and suddenly people are struggling to make ends meet. And that's why we have the middle class shrinking and, you know, a growing gap in our country between rich, super rich, and the rest of us.
Well, let's do this, Danny Schechter. After we complete this interview off the air, let's talk about bringing you and this documentary, In Debt We Trust, into Detroit. By the way, people, you can go to indebtwetrust.com and see the trailer and
You can also order the DVD. I mean, what we're trying to do with this is sort of the democratization of information. Let's get house parties going in people's homes. Let's get them going in union halls and in churches and the like, so that people can see what's going on and realize that they're not alone. You know, a lot of people who have financial problems blame themselves. Nobody likes to talk about money. It's embarrassing, okay? So they tend to blame themselves, you know, not realizing that they, in many cases, have been targeted. I mean, there are people who are irresponsible about their spending behavior. You know, we're in a country now where everybody's scamming, you know, in a sense, to just survive. You know, we're scamming the banks are scamming us, and the like. But, you know, guess who's winning? I mean, you know, we have a transfer of wealth, hundreds of billions of dollars going from, in a sense, poor and working people into the vaults of big financial institutions. I mean, Goldman Sachs, the investment bank, last year paid out in Christmas bonuses, just bonuses, $16.8 billion. So you can imagine how much money they're making.
That's a B? That's a billion? $16 billion?
And you know, you have a situation with, you know, the average wage in the financial services sector here in New York on Wall Street, the average wage, okay, is $8,520 a week, okay, up $3,000 in the last 3 years. Now, how many people are making that who are listening to you? I venture to guess not that many. So, you know, you have a growing enrichment of a small group of people and a growing, you know, in a sense, impoverishment of the rest of us. And this is a situation that, you know, can't continue. It's unsustainable, and yet there's so much economic pain. When I was in Detroit driving, you know, through the neighborhood I used to live in over on East Grand Boulevard, just seeing the destruction there, the wasteland, it looked like Sarajevo after the war, you know, Berlin. You know, I mean, in other words, nothing much has been done to rebuild the city. You have vast acres. It could be a farm.
I was going to say, we always say it's Detroit almost ready for farming again.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is something which, you know, to my eyes was sort of shocking, but it's also a commentary on the reality. I spoke to somebody from Dayton, Ohio. They say whole neighborhoods have been devastated by foreclosure. There was an article about, you know, I forget the block in Detroit, you know, where this woman is quoted as saying, you know, when I see dandelions start coming up on the lawns of my neighbors, I realize they're not cutting their lawns anymore. And I realize they're not cutting their lawns because they're losing their homes. Okay?
Wow.
You know, one block, three homes, four homes foreclosed upon. And, you know, so these were stable middle-class neighborhoods. These were not, you know, people who were living in dire poverty, you know, in the inner-city ghetto. These were people whose lives had been improved, you know, worked in the plants, worked, you know, to improve their families. And now they're facing a big conundrum. You know, Hamtramck, you know, suddenly the water bills have gone up. People losing their homes. You know, I mean, this is unfortunately an economic survival story for many people. It's also an economic justice issue. And I wish that the unions, even though they're having so many problems of their own, would get on this and really start crusading to save people's homes, to save people's lives. And that's why part of what we're doing with In Debt We Trust on our website, stopthesqueeze.org, stopthesqueeze.org, is to fight for debt relief in America the way Bono and the rock stars and everybody have fought for debt relief in Africa. We have a situation here of growing, you know, poverty, and it's not just poor people, it's college students leaving school, $40,000 in debt. What do these kids do? They have to immediately get a job, no matter where, to start paying back the banks. I mean, this affects the rest of their lives. This is not something that, you know, is just, well, isn't this unfortunate? It's a little problem. It's not a little problem. It's a big, massive problem, and the scary thing about it, you know, that's really scary, is that a lot of the experts, the financial experts, a lot of them are just saying, you know, everything is good, America's never been stronger, blah, 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 blah. But a lot of people are expressing deep concern about this. They see inflation around the corner. They see gas prices continuing to rise. They see people being squeezed and not being able to afford to live, which leads to, guess what, more crime. Mm-hmm. It leads to more desperation. People lose hope. They lose their homes. And you know, and this is a bigger problem, believe it or not, than Katrina.
Well,
more people will lose their homes in America by foreclosure than by flood.
The documentary we're talking about is In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst. It's a Danny Schechter dissection, and we're talking with Danny in New York City. The website's In Debt We Trust or StopTheSqueeze.org. I'll have a link on my site, PeterWerby.com, as well. Danny Schechter, talk to us a little about some of the aspects of a debt. That is usury. Explain what usury is. And
usury is like, you know, what Jesus was against, okay? You know, when he went into the
drive them out, yeah.
And drive out the money changers was because of high interest charges. You know, we've gone, you know, interest rates up to 30% now. In some cases, for short-term loans, if you're using a payday lender or one of these tax refund joints, you could be paying something like 700% interest, rent-to-own stores. I mean, it's obscene.
Where's the mafia now that we need them? It'd be better to go to a loan shark.
The mafia was more ethical than this. You know, one of the things I did in my films, I went down to Norfolk, Virginia, and I went to the Navy base there. You know, soldiers and sailors coming back from Iraq. And what happens is they grow increasingly in debt. There used to be 3 payday lenders across from the base. Now there are 26. When I was there, there may be more now. And these people, you know, are rolling over these loans constantly, paying more and more interest. And you know, no banks in the inner city, so people are using check cashing stores, et cetera, and so forth. And the consequence is that people are being, you know, poorer, getting poorer and poorer. So it's an economic inequality, economic injustice, and debt is driving it in part, you know. I mean, our economic policies are not helping, the lack of a social safety net, the lack of social investment in our cities, in our communities. Of course, that's also depleting people's resources. But, you know, this is a tremendous problem, and it's affecting the suburbs. It's not just inner city, you know, Detroit that's hurting here. Many communities that we would have considered to be, you know, middle class communities are you know, affected by this. You know, cities of like Atlanta and Washington, D.C., both, you know, largely black cities, are now becoming white cities because the people who fled from those cities are now returning because they don't want to pay the commuting costs and buying apartments in the city, driving out poor people, gentrification, changing whole neighborhoods, changing the whole demography of our community. So this is having tremendous consequences in our cities, and it's something that's very of deep concern to me. I was in Detroit. I spoke with Grace Lee Boggs. I guess you know who that
sure,
is. I
mean, of course.
She's like a national treasure, a legend. You know, she was telling me about what's happening in the neighborhoods. And, you know, there are young people there that are creating, at the end of June, a community media conference there, that which I, you know, think is very interesting to try to communicate some of these issues. You know, as schools get closed, consolidated, and the like, you know, people are feeling like unwelcome in their own communities. So this is something that's a very Detroit, you know, issue, but it's a national issue too.
Well, Danny Schechter, let's go back to these interest rates. Of course, Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages was inveighing against usury, and Well, aren't there usury laws? I mean, how did
well,
they
get away?
What's
happened is if you want to see the consumer protection laws, if you want to see the laws against usury, go to the library, okay? That's where you'll find them because they're no longer on the books. Why? Because the big financial institutions, real estate developers, et cetera, have invested a lot of money in politics, and they've been lobbying in Congress. They've been lobbying, you know, at the state level as well. I mean, I'm told that in Lansing there was a measure to try to, you know, do something about predatory lending, and, you know, it was a good bill, but it failed because of the lobbying pressure of these industries and because a lot of other people are not paying attention to this problem, including progressives who are just, you know, looking the other way at what's happening, not really aware of the consequences of all this. So this is an issue that really affects the state of Michigan, the city of Detroit, all the communities around it, and our whole country. And I'm very worried about this because I don't want to be a prophet of doom and say, you know, it's all going to come falling down. I'm not Humpty Dumpty here. But it could, you know. We just had a 400 drop in the market not that long ago over these subprime loans. You know, the people who can afford to invest and play in the market, which is like a big casino, which is something that Detroit knows about, they, you know, they're making a ton of money, the hedge funds and the like. But what about the rest of us? This is not something that everybody's taking part in. It's just a small percentage, you know, of the financial movers and groovers are making the money here, and the rest of us are paying the bill.
Well, one of the things I thought was extraordinarily interesting in your documentary, In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst, was that this wasn't a, like, quote, liberal or left or progressive issue, but you had a number of Republicans and conservatives expressing great concern.
Interestingly, this issue cuts across partisan lines, generational lines, ethnic lines, racial lines. You know, it's an issue that actually could unite Americans instead of further dividing them, because everybody is hurting. Everybody feels, you know, the pain and feels the need to do something about it. So it's not just a a problem for one group of people. We need to get to build some sort of movement for economic justice across the spectrum here.
Well, tell us about
people involved.
Tell us about some of the people who you wouldn't have expected to see in a Danny Schechter film.
I went to the Marine, met the Marines and the sailors at in Norfolk at the military base, and found out that, you know, the people coming back from Iraq are being charged interest rates that would make the mob blush. Okay, I spoke with Dave Ramsey, who has a very popular conservative radio show. You know, he's, you know, leading a campaign to cut up your credit cards. You know, he holds up a card. He said, "This is Capital One. Let's make it two," and cuts it in half. Lou Cherico, federal former prosecutor, who's a defense lawyer now. You know, who's basically saying, you know, that we're getting back, you know, that what the mob did in the old days of, you know, loan sharking and the like, that these companies are doing, something even worse. Okay, so he's making that comparison. He prosecuted loan sharks. So I try to reach out across the spectrum because I want people to relate to this issue no matter where they are. A lot of people have different, you know, they play a blame game. It's somebody's fault, the people who spend too much. Well, partly that's true. But they don't look at the institutions behind it. It's, you know, one of the people I relied on in this book is a former Reagan advisor who wrote about what he called financialization. In other words, the way financial institutions are driving our economy. And he, you know, points to the credit and loan complex that's every bit as insidious, okay, as the military-industrial complex. So that's what we're up against, the concentrated financial power in just 10 banks are dominating 92% of the credit cards in America, et cetera, and so forth. So we need regulation. We need education. We need financial literacy in our schools. We need people to take more responsibility. At the same time, we need corporations to be forced to take more responsibility and to be accountable, to be transparent in their practices, instead of engaging in all this deceptive advertising, which I show, in the film. So again, if you go to stopthesqueeze.org and debtwetrust.com, you're going to find out a lot of information about this problem and about this film and Debt We Trust that I, that you probably didn't know before.
What?
And might want to get involved on the issue, you know?
Well, yeah. In fact, we've got about 5 minutes left towards the end of it. Let's tell how people could do it in
okay.
house parties and getting the DVD
right.
Stop the Debt.
You know, partly this is a function also of our media failure to really explain these issues. A lot of the TV channels, you know, are focusing on identity theft, you know, minor consumer abuses, not institutional abuses, not the way these banks have overcharged people. Today, like last week, Columbia University here in New York City, one of the top Ivy League schools, paid a $1 million settlement because their financial aid officers were steering students to more expensive loans than the government, less costly government loans, because they were getting gifts and payoffs from Sallie Mae, one of the loan companies. They were forced to make a settlement. So there's a whole scandal within the scandal here of people getting rich off of this and ripping people off and getting paid to do so. So this is something that, you know, we have to look into as well, the sort of deception that's going on and the way in which some, you know, very nefarious type people are profiting off of predatory lending that's victimizing people.
Well,
this is something that, you know, it's a big field. The film is a feature-length documentary. It goes into this in some detail. It shows how things are connected in ways that most of the TV coverage doesn't. You know, I edit the mediachannel.org, which is a large website dealing with media issues, and we've been writing about this. We think the media needs to do a better job of investigating these subprime loans, investigating who's behind this crisis and who's getting rich off of it.
Yeah, it actually is sort of an obscene specter of the ultra-wealthy loaning money to the middle class and the working class and the poor at extraordinary rates of interest. But Danny Schechter, before our time goes completely away, you already went over in kind of broad detail some solutions. When you mentioned it, and it's shown so well, it's actually a great segment in Debt We Trust, where the talk show host is cutting all of the credit cards in half and making jokes about them. But that sort of makes the suggestion that it's the individual responsibility, and we do have responsibility as individuals, obviously, to try to live.
Well, that's what makes this issue so complicated in some ways and simple on other levels. Complicated because, if you ever tried to read a credit card agreement, okay, which is written in a way to be unreadable, okay, so complicated, so dense, so many words, so many pages, you can't make sense out of it. You know that you're being deceived, that they're just sort of risk-adverse lawyers who are drafting these agreements to benefit themselves. So that's complicated on one hand. And on the other hand, then they turn around and say, look, you signed the agreement. You didn't know what you were signing. In fact, it was designed so you wouldn't know what you were signing. But nevertheless, you signed it, therefore it's your responsibility. So we have to be aware of these traps. We have to be aware of this. But we also have to, in a deeper level, be aware of how, you know, there's a sickness in our country called affluenza, where everybody is buying things all the time, consuming much more than they need, and all of that, and incurring debt to do it. We have to be a little bit more mindful of where the real values are, and how we can try to get some sort of fairness and equity into our economy, because, you know, sure, not there now.
Well, it's, as you said, part of it is structural and legal and what Congress permits. And if people are paying 750%, interest, or even 18 and 20%, I mean, that's obscene.
I show in the film, for example, the bankruptcy, quote, reform bill, which makes it much more difficult to file bankruptcy. And I, you know, reported that, $151 million was spent in lobbying the Congress to pass this bill, and that many Democrats voted for it as well as Republicans. So this is not just a question of, you know, Big Bad Bush. This is a question of, you know, a lot of people aligned, because they're benefiting off of this system in some way. They're politicians. They're getting donations and contributions from these financial institutions. So, you know, how do we fight back against this? I mean, you live in a city in Detroit where at one time in the history of, you know, our country, the labor movement made great strides, and people believed in solidarity. They believed in working together and fighting for what was right, and they accomplished a lot more than they ever thought they would. And then, of course, what's happened over the years is a lot of the spirit of the unions has disappeared. A lot of the people are laid off or no longer working, but yet we need those institutions to organize their members to fight back against this, to educate them about it. And that's why I'd like to offer my film to unions in Detroit. Let's show it. Let's get people to talk about this problem, see what we can do about it.
Well, let's you and I, after, because we're completely out of time, let's you and I, Danny Schechter, talk about how we can get this shown in
Detroit.
Thank you, Detroit.
For having me on. And for me, you know, anytime, because I really love your work and I love Detroit.
Well, it's obviously mutual. Let me tell people, though, that they can go to stopthesqueeze.org, indebtwetrust.com. The DVD is In Debt We Trust, America Before the Bubble Burst. My guest has been the producer and director, Danny Schechter. Get this DVD. Don't wait for other people. Show it to your friends. Check it out yourself.
A lot of parents are showing it to their kids to try to prevent them from getting caught up in this trap.
Danny Schechter, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
My pleasure.
WRIM.com.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy. Yeah. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting the fear stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. And I've had too much caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was, in platform double suede. Yeah, there she was, like disco lemonade. Yeah. I smell sex and candlelit. Yeah. Who's that lounging? Yeah. Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah, yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah, yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. I smell sex and candlelit, yeah. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah, mama, this surely. Yeah, mama, this must be my dream.
WRIF presents Detroit's International River Days, June 22nd to the 27th, featuring live music, great food, and lots of family fun. Don't miss the cool free concerts on the EDS stage, including Kenny Wayne Shepherd. Plus, there's Pure Michigan's One on the Water with a DTE Energy Parade of Lights, Coast Guard Days, jet ski demos, and more. There's also Fun on Land with a classic car show and carnival. River Day starts June 22nd by GM World Headquarters, and it's totally free. For info, go to DetroitRiverDays.com.
Sponsored by General Motors, Sprint, CompuWare, Metro Times, WXYZ Channel 7, the Detroit Marriott,
and 101 WRIM. Everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. This is media. Actually, this isn't media. Media is plural for medium. This is one of the many media that we're now faced with. Many of us, particularly if we're older, simply had a couple things, a couple, three things available. Print, radio, and television. About to stop there. I guess recorded music as well. Things have certainly spread out in the last 20 years, haven't they? And we also talk on this broadcast about the mainstream media. In fact, even to the point of calling it the MSM. That means all the broadcast national networks and also, of course, cable and of course, expanding from there as well. But there are alternatives. There are people putting out their own media, partly through the Internet, partly self-published books, poetry, magazines, and newspapers that go back, some of them even 100 years. But there's going to be a very, very interesting conference that I'm going to take part in. It's coming right up in our town, Detroit. It's called the Allied Media Conference. It's the ninth manifestation of it. It's going to be held in Detroit June 22nd to the 24th, most of it at Wayne State University in downtown Detroit. And heretofore, it's been held in Bowling Green, Ohio. And we're fortunate, though, to have it here in Detroit. Joining me is Mike Meadow, who's an organizer from Detroit. And Mike, welcome to the broadcast. And also Josh Breitbart, who is an organizer, and he's in from New York City. Mike and Josh, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter. Hi.
Well, for those of, and probably most people, don't know what the Allied Media Conference is. Maybe, Josh, you could start and give us an idea what's happened for the last 8 years or eight media conferences.
It's basically the time of the year when all of the people who make media of all different kinds, as you were saying, alternative media that might be newspapers or radio shows or public access television, come together and share the work that they've been doing, talk about what the future holds, and just try and build a strong community around that.
Mike Meadow, tell us, why Detroit? How did it move from Bowling Green, Ohio, here to our city?
Well, I've been attending the conference in Bowling Green for about 5 or 6 years. And it came to a time when the organizers who had been organizing the conference in Bowling Green wanted to transition the conference to a new location. And myself and other independent media activists who were based in Michigan, based in Detroit, basically put out an offer that we could host the conference here. And we've worked for the past 2 years to lay the groundwork for bringing the conference to Detroit.
Now, there is a marked difference, of course, in the venues. Bowling Green, Ohio, at the university there, which I attended several of them, spoke at a couple of them. They nice, idyllic campus, much like our own Ann Arbor here. But Detroit, certainly a different venue, and I suspect that the content of the people attending is going to be a bit different as well. And in fact, you guys have made sure that that happens.
Oh, yeah, we've done a lot to connect with people in Detroit. I mean, as Mike was saying, there was already a lot of attendance from Detroit, and the energy was really here. It was just an incredible opportunity for the conference to come here. But just the history of independent media and social movements in Detroit are just incredible, and all of that is being represented, both past and present. We've got, Detroit Summer, Michigan Citizen, yourself. Public access shows, I can't even start down the list. Mike, you know more of it.
Well, I was impressed. In fact, if you go to the conference website, alliedmediaconference.org, you'll see an extraordinary list of people that are making media, that are not just sitting and watching. They're actually actively producing media. And therein lies a real difference. Mostly, we talk about living in the society of the spectacle, where life is defined for us through the media. And at best, we're taking this all in passively, and at best what we do is we respond to the ads. But here, in fact, Mike Meadow, you mentioned media activists. That's sort of a, probably for a lot of people, a weird conjunction of terms. Could maybe explain that a little.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there that are doing work that could be characterized as media activist work that don't necessarily refer to themselves by that term. I mean, you know, especially with you know, the explosion of digital technologies and the internet, so many people are getting involved in self-publishing. If you just look at the explosion of activity around blogging and that sort of thing, and with technologies that allow you to do recording, like this kind of radio production that we're doing right now, or video production, it's becoming much cheaper and much more accessible. So a lot of people are finding a way to get involved in becoming media makers. And at a conference like the Allied Media Conference, it's about organizing all these people to say, well, what are we producing media for? What is our purpose? And for the argument we're putting out there is that we can use all of these new media technologies in struggles to advance social justice, to make our communities better, and to make our lives better.
Yeah, it's a lot of people's experience of the media is like getting driven around on a big bus. You know, maybe if you're lucky, it's getting chauffeured in a limousine. And the Allied Media Conference is really about looking under the hood, seeing how it all gets put together.
Now, this is not just political media either, is it?
No, a lot of people, you know, make it about personal. It's about personal expression. And, you know, a lot of the ways that people engage it transform the world in small ways as well as in large ways, or transform neighbors or themselves through creating their small zine publication. And other people, you know, are working on nationally syndicated radio shows there. So it's a real mix of audiences.
And the word zine that you use, I hope by now most people are familiar with that. It essentially means a self-published, printed. It's not used electronically, or is it now?
No, for the most part, it's a phenomenon that came about when Xerox copiers were around, and all of a sudden people could sneak off and make copies and make little booklets of their journals. Now, you know, electronically, people often use blogs.
And also, what we're talking about here, the ability to make media electronically, is in many ways part of the democratization of media. Because if you go back a generation when the so-called underground press began in the 1960s, that also was about a technological innovation. That is, that previously that printing a newspaper was quite a big deal. But with offset printing, suddenly it became available to almost anybody that had a few bucks and could pay a printer. And now, of course, it's the price of it all has cheapened incredibly, so the access is almost available to everyone. I wonder, though, can there be too much media?
Well, I think, you know, one thing to think about, it may feel like an embarrassment of riches these days, but a lot of that access is actually under threat. Even with those small publications, you know, the Postal Service Commission just changed the rates for the way small newspapers are sent out, so it actually favors large publications. So you might be able to print your publication, but actually mailing it out to people and distributing it might be becoming harder. And you have, you know, cable television and all these you know, corporate media that are consolidating, saying, well, people have the internet now, so they don't need to have access to the airwaves or to the cable stations. So it's really important that you know, that we not rest on what we have, but we really you know, strengthen what we have access to and use it.
Maybe, Josh, you could strengthen a little what you said about the postal rate increase. I mean, we all know that, I don't know, not so long ago, weren't stamps like 15 cents, now they're 41 cents. But what is required of small publications has just jumped up tremendously. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, basically, you know, the postal rates are, you know, get set by a commission, and they recommend to the, you know, to the post office what they should charge for stamps. And they recommended, you know, moderate increase. But Time Warner, which owns some publishing assets as well as television assets, recommended that they change it in such a way that it went up proportionally higher for the smaller publications. And so, it's just, and we already know, I think everybody in this room and maybe some people listening to us have worked on small publications, and a lot of the ones we know are fading away. Clamor Magazine, which used to be published out of Toledo, Ohio, closed recently. They were involved in founding the Allied Media Conference. Satya Magazine, a publication in New York, recently closed. It's a challenging time for that type of independent press.
Well, I think there's two aspects. One is the increasing cost of everything, of course. Print bills are way up, and working on the Fifth Estate newspaper, that's, in fact, folks, you can check that out at fifthestate.org, that there's a lot of challenges, and the postal increase, which the Nation magazine estimated, I can't remember the figure now, but their postal rates are going, or their postal expenses are going to go up several $100,000 this year, which could have the capacity to drive out any number of smaller publications. And in fact, the people that were contesting this were across the political spectrum, the Nation on the left, the National Review on the right, and those are now what is going to be facing small publications. Also, though, it is, which you were talking about, the expansion, we both were, about the expansion of media, that print seems so 20th century. Any speculation as to the future of it? I know, Mike Meadow, you work with an incredibly vibrant local publication.
Yeah, I work with a magazine called Critical Moment that comes out six times a year. It's a magazine documenting social justice movements in the Southeast Michigan area. And the challenge right now, I think, is to figure out, well if we're going to continue publishing these print publications, what is the purpose of a print publication? Because there, obviously, you can just put everything up on the web. But what could be the role of print publications in doing a different form of outreach and reaching people that might not otherwise find your website? And it's also a different experience, reading something in print, the experience of being able to lay something out and have nice pictures. You just have a different way of interacting with the ideas that are presented. So I think right now is a time where where print is really challenged. We need to figure out what is the core reasons that we do print, and how do we locate the resources that are going to be necessary to allow us to keep publishing. And now more than ever, it's really important for different small print publications to be in dialogue with one another and sharing ideas about how we can support one another, because we're all facing these challenges. And fortunately, at the Allied Media Conference, we're going to be doing a caucus of print publications where people that work on print can come together and share ideas. So that that's one of the core focuses of the Allied Media Conference, is to allow the space for those kind of dialogues to happen.
We're talking about the 9th annual Allied Media Conference happening here in Detroit, June 22nd to June 24th, mostly held at Wayne State University. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Mike Meadow, who's an organizer from Detroit, and John Breitbart, who's an organizer from New York, who's come in to help put this all together. You can go to alliedmediaconference.org. If you go to my website, there's a link as well, Peter Werbe, Werbe.org as well. Yes, I'm going to be part of that caucus on the future of print media. But maybe, we're from a different generation, so I sometimes worry that, I'm just, as people have told me, I'm so 20th century, radio and print media. And you've exactly hit it, Mike, that it's the experience. To me, for one thing, I cannot read real long articles on screen. Can you guys do that? Can you sit and write and read, like, say, a 2,000-word essay on that's so 20th century in and of itself, but could you read like a 2,000-word essay on screen?
Well, if we can find a good 2,000-word essay on the internet, then I can sit and read it. But I think that's sometimes the challenge.
Yeah. Mike, because one of the things that I like to do, I find myself, because the internet is all about speed, so I find myself blasting through these long articles, whereas when it's in print, you stop, you think, you go back, wait a minute, let me go back a few paragraphs, and wait a minute, who is this guy that they're quoting now? But there seems to be so much more room for reflection in print.
Yeah, and I mean, you just interact with reading the printed word in a different way. I mean, you don't necessarily take your computer everywhere that you might take a magazine or a book, and I just think that there continues to be a role for print even in the age where a lot of people are getting their news from the internet. You know, a lot of people aren't getting their news from the internet, and those people have people that aren't online have a right to access to these ideas. They have a right to be able to see these 2,000 word articles in print, and they have a right to take it with them on a picnic or wherever they might go, where they might not be taking their laptop.
Let's talk a little about the contents of the Allied Media Conference. And this is open to the public, right? And we'd like to encourage people to show up. This is not just for, or is it? Is it just for media specialists, media activists, or?
Oh no, there are a lot of different points of entry. As we in this room have been working on it for years, you'll find a home there. But also there are, introductions to writing, and you can get started making radio. Basically, it's for all levels. There's a modest registration fee. It's on a sliding scale. But everybody is encouraged to attend, just like the Allied Media Conference encourages everybody to take part in making media.
And I know that, in fact, I assume, like years gone by, there'll be booths. People will be displaying what they're doing, whether it's newspapers or whatever.
Yeah, and we'll even actually be building a radio transmitter on site. So if you want to take part in that, it's micro radio, so it's not going to compete with these stations.
Yeah.
But it will, show you how these stations work. The same principles apply, transmitter to antenna.
And is there still room for exhibitors to contact? Or are you?
Yeah, we have a few tables left. I mean, I would encourage people, if they want to get a display table, either to promote the work that they're doing or to sell different materials, that they should get in touch with us as soon as possible so that they can get one of the limited number of tables we have left. And they can do that through our website, alliedmediaconference.org.
Well, tell us some about the conference program. I see there's special presentations. Like, what does that mean? What are they going to be?
Well, there's several special presentations. On Friday of the conference is actually a symposium on popular education, which is a whole day of workshops geared towards educators, but also for anyone that's interested in these ideas. That is the ideas of popular education, how we can create new educational models that are more dynamic and more engaging for students, and also that can incorporate all the media technologies that we're talking about. And that day, the Symposium on Popular Education, is going to open up with a keynote discussion with Grace Lee Boggs, who's a 92-year-old movement activist in the city of Detroit that's been involved in educational issues for a long time. There's also going to be an opening ceremony, which is a big event featuring leaders in the Detroit community and some spoken word and poetry and music, just kind of welcoming the Allied Media Conference to the city of Detroit because, as you mentioned before, the conference had been in Bowling Green for 8 years, and now is the first year in Detroit.
That leads me to a little parenthesis here before we get on more to what people can expect at the Allied Media Conference, and we just sort of alluded to it. There wasn't great diversity in terms of class and race when it was in Bowling Green, as fine as those events were, but you guys have really gone out of your way to make this conference reflect the diversity of people that are making media and of the city of Detroit.
I mean, so many people in Detroit wanted to take part. The travel to Bowling Green, the environment of Bowling Green may have discouraged the participation of some people. And just from all over the country, really, the breadth of participation has really exploded with the move to Detroit. I think people from Detroit will be surprised by how much activity there is going on around them. And people from outside of Detroit, I know, are going to be really excited when they get here.
And I thought it was wonderful that the Allied Media Conference actually had room in its budget to have stipends for young people from other parts of the country that couldn't afford to come here.
Youth organizations from across the country are coming, and a lot of the workshops. Last year, actually, was the first time we tried hard to gear some of the content towards youth, and the response from the youth was positive. They wanted to be the presenters. So this year they are actually the ones running a number of the workshops, and we'll be in the audience learning from them.
And the panel discussions and workshops, those are going to both be how-to and also just kind of show and tell? Like
Yeah, it's they're really designed to like work as a package. So, for example, we're talking about talking about radio. Like I said, we're talking about we're building a transmitter, so you'll know how that happened. We're also having workshops on how to produce community news, work as a team to produce content for the radio, and then we're also having discussions around the future of radio and the policies and regulations. What's happened with consolidation? There's been a huge decrease in the number of in the amount of minority ownership of radio stations, but there's also opportunities coming up for new licenses for low-power FM stations and even for full-power radio stations. So the community organizations and your local congregations or what have you can get together and get new licenses. So we're really going to be talking about things from all angles, and we're going to do that in television, print, and the internet as well.
I actually was remiss in not giving the title of the conference, the Allied Media Conference 2007, Breaking Silence, Building Movements. So there is a political concern here of the use of media of for alternatives to what we see on a regular basis on the mainstream media or the MSM. And I know, as I'm sure you do, throughout our history in America, that the role of media, beginning in the 1880s with the labor press and into the early 20th century, again, with labor and socialist groups and anarchist groups and what have you, and during the 1960s, the so-called underground press movement, where there were hundreds and hundreds of weekly papers, that it defined the type of, and I forgot the 1930s, that defined for many people a reality that was never reflected in the mainstream media of that huge sweep of time that I mentioned. And do you see that, what's happening at the Allied Media Conference as part of that process as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're talking about, all those movements. There really was a sense that if you wanted to make political change, it was important to either start a newspaper or you somehow had to have a way of communicating, and you built community around these outlets. But, as we're talking, there's been an explosion in people's ability to create new media outlets and to build community around them. But that also means that we're somewhat fragmented. So what the Allied Media Conference does is it takes all these, networks that are built around a small newspaper or a small radio station or a public access television station or a web-based project, and everybody comes together and we connect those networks. So we really are, building a whole social movement really around this media network.
And how would you compare this to some of those? I can't remember the name of the big conference. Like there was one in St. Louis.
The Free Press Conference, National Conference for Media Reform.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, as I said, I mean, we talk about some of those media policy issues, but those conferences, I think they're great experiences, and they bring huge numbers of people into the movement, but they tend to address most people as media consumers, as those riders on the bus. And we talk about, the people at the Allied Media Conference are driving the bus, and if they're, if they're in the passenger seat, we're going to give them a chance at the wheel. That's really the goal of this conference, is to give people, like I said, a look under the hood and really take a holistic view of how the media works and how it impacts our lives.
And that could be anybody, right? Anybody with anything to say. I mean, I just think about the possibilities, particularly with the conviviality of the computer technology. I mean, you put out little newsletters for your block, right? You don't have to just depend on you're never going to see yourself except unless there's something bad happened onto you on the local news. You can start little block newsletters, little caucuses in your unions at your schools or whatever. It's really unlimited. It's a matter of gaining the confidence to do that. And I suspect from what you've said so far, the Allied Media Conference is where people could pick up the skill sets and also the self confidence that goes with it. To initiate something.
If you had any doubt before you got to the media conference that you could be a media producer, it will be gone within minutes. Just the amount of different projects, the different points of entry, different styles, different technologies, it really can work for anybody. And as you're saying, really is about that local, building that local community. And as media corporations have consolidated around the country, and we've really lost a sense of local media in a lot of cases, and we have the power to to bring that back ourselves.
Yeah, and even the phrase you used, Josh, media producer, sounds a little foreboding. I mean, people can quickly learn the skills to put out like what they call a poetry chapbook, and essentially they're a media producer then, right?
Yeah, there's a couple workshops at the AMC that I'm really excited about that I think are good examples of that kind of you know, good points of entry. One is a DIY animation workshop, you know, which is just like an introduction to how you with not expensive technologies can start producing some animation shorts. There's another workshop on becoming a writer and how you can refine your writing techniques and even start self-publishing. I mean, there's a lot of workshops that are going to be happening at the Allied Media Conference, which are good points of entry for people that are just getting started.
Well, it's an absolutely incredible experience. I hope a number of you listening take advantage of this. It's the Allied Media Conference, the 9th annual. It's going to be held here in Detroit, June 22nd through the 24th. That's a weekend, mostly at the Wayne State University. We're out of time, so we can't even mention the fun aspects of this. If you go to alliedmediaconference.org, it's all there. I want to thank Mike Meadow and Josh Breitbart, organizers for the conference, for coming down and talking to us on the Peter Werbe Show. And I'll see you down at the 9th Annual Allied Media Conference.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
So we're from Jacksonville, Florida. There's another band from Jacksonville, Florida, which you guys might have heard of. They're called Lynyrd Skynyrd. You ever heard of them? Jason Todd over here playing a rebel flag. The song's called Simple Man.
Well, Mama told me when I was young to sit beside me, my only son, and listen closely. It'll help you some sunny day. Ah, it will. Yeah, it will. Oh, take your time. Don't live too fast. Troubles will come, and they will pass. You'll find a warm arm, and you'll find love. And don't forget that there is a someone up above. So be a simple kind of man. If you can, if you can, if you can. Won't get you lost from the rich man's gold. All that you need now is in your soul, and you can do this.
101 WRIF
is right
back in 4 or less,
and they love you.
Ooh,
do they love you?
Everything rocks.